Right. Good morning. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order. It is 9:04 on Friday, October 8th, 2021. We have a roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Present.
Robert Charles. Mary Coonrod. Present. Cedric Davis.
Good morning.
Patricia Dobratz.
Present.
Lynette Hennigan.
Present.
Megan Kramer. Cassandra Parr. Heidi Quinlan.
Present.
Mark Shen.
Present.
Gerald Szymanski.
Present.
Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Patricia Dobratz. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and the board's chairperson. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody to please turn your phones on silent, including board members. Throughout the meeting, if somebody needs to use the restroom, it is out those doors across from the elevators. And for your convenience, there's also vending machines right outside the boardroom to the left. This meeting is going to be recorded, and the audio from this meeting will be posted on the board's website. As such, we appreciate everyone speaking clearly and into the microphones. At this point, I'm going to ask board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Ms. Quinlan.
Heidi Quinlan, professional member.
Angela Trotter, public member.
Dr. Lynette Hennigan, professional member.
Emily Bailey, professional member.
Gerald Szymanski, professional member.
Doc Davis, LCSW, professional member.
Mark Shen, professional member.
Public member.
Erin Yabu, deputy director.
Alyssa Vanderveen, operations manager.
Ian Hermann, assistant director.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board.
Thank you. We're going to first go to agenda item number 3, our review of minutes. And for 3A, our August 13th general meeting minutes, Ms. Coonrod will need to abstain. Otherwise, is there a motion to accept those minutes?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Fowler second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. And we do not have quorum for 3B, our September 10th minutes, so those will be tabled. Then we're going to jump to agenda item number 5, our administrative hearing. Ricky Ingram, is the complainant or the licensee here for that case? I believe we're getting counsel on the phone.
Michael.
And this is Patricia, the board's chairperson. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Hi, this is Michael Rain, Assistant Attorney General, here to provide independent legal advice.
Thank you. And this is for a request for a continuance for Mr. Ingram's administrative hearing, and as well as you.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Mr. Ingram is licensed by the board. Currently, his license is suspended based on a non-renewal. He is scheduled for a formal hearing for October 28th. Based on the information I've uploaded to the member portal, based on the unavailability of the counsel due to medical issues, they are asking for continuance of this matter. I do ask that the board members, if you do consider a continuance in this matter, that we grant it as a one-time continuance and to be scheduled in January. And that's all I have, unless you have questions for me.
Any questions from board members, Ms. Wallace? Ms. Baskin, does the state have a position?
Yes. Good morning. Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Arizona in this matter. The board issued its complaint notice of hearing in this matter on September 17th of this year. Mr. Ingram's counsel, Mr. Mansker, contacted counsel and Ms. Zavala regarding requesting a continuance. That continuance was received in writing on October 6th, although we had discussions last week. As far as the state's position in this case, the state does not oppose this one-time continuance and would request that the matter be scheduled for sometime in January.
Any questions or comments from board members? Is there a motion to grant a one-time continuance and have the matter rescheduled for January?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Davis, second. Yes, please.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod?
Aye.
Cedric Davis?
Aye.
Patricia Dobrat?
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan?
Aye.
Heidi Quinlan?
Aye.
Mark Shen?
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Aye.
All right, the motion to continue is granted, and so board members, note that we will not have the formal that was scheduled for this month, and Ms. Zavala will be reaching out to us to get that rescheduled for January. Mr. Rain, thank you for being available to us.
Have a good meeting.
Have a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Rain.
So next, we will go to agenda item number 4, and that's our consent agenda. So unless anyone would like to address the board on one of these matters, the board will vote to approve it as it appears on the agenda. I'm going to read through each matter and ask if there is somebody to pull it, and then I will start calling the cases once I know which cases will be pulled. For 4A, are cases recommended for dismissal. Is there anybody here who wishes to address the board on Leslie Silsinger matter?
Madam Chair, I believe that this case has been pulled and the complainant is on the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so that one's been pulled. A2, Heidi Quinlan matter. Is there anybody here who's just pulled up? Are you the complainant in the matter? Okay. And A3, Julie Wasnowitz-Moore.
That has also been pulled and the complainant will be on the phone.
Thank you.
Period. Licensee or present.
Perfect. All right, so we're going to take these one by one. For everybody's information, we do have all of the materials in this matter. We've reviewed those. The way that we will proceed is board staff will have time to present to the board, and then the complainant will have up to 5 minutes or equal to the board's time that it took to present the case, and then the licensee would have equal time as well to address the board. We'll first go to A1. Leslie Silsinger. We are getting the complainant on the phone, is that correct? Carvis, if you and your client would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, of course. Good morning. Mandy Carvis of Wickersmith, appearing with and on behalf of my client, Leslie Silsinger.
Madam Chair, I think that it would be appropriate to try one more time. We did receive information that this individual wanted to be called and knew that they'd be being called shortly after 9.
Okay. Try one more time.
This is Kimberly. Can I help you?
This is Patricia, the board's chairperson.
Yes.
Good morning. We are getting ready to hear Ms. Silsinger's matter. And the way that we'll proceed, board members are here along with board staff. The licensee and her attorney are here as well. And board staff will have a chance to present to the board, and then you'll have up to 5 minutes to address the board or equal time as the board took. We do have all of the materials in this matter. But if you wish to add something, you can do so. And then the licensee and her attorney will have a chance to address the board as well.
Okay, who is her attorney, please?
It is Mandy Carvis, who's representing the licensee.
I beg your pardon. Can you say that again so that I can write it down?
Sure. Mandy Carvis.
Mandy Carvis. Can you spell the last name, please?
A-A-R, B as in Victor, I-S.
K as in Catherine, A-R.
B as in Victor, I, S as in Sam.
Perfect.
Yep. And I would ask that you mute your phone until we're ready to hear from you, please. Thank you. Ms. Zavala?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions for board staff? Kimberly, you now have up to 5 minutes to address the board if there is anything you would like to add.
Yes, I'm unmuting myself. Thank you. As this matter is a topic of a federal lawsuit, as you know, I'm going to choose my words wisely. As parents, by the way, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Very good. As parents, our number one job is to raise our children with a strong moral character. Above all else, for their entire lives, this will serve them and society, including affecting the generations to come. Raising my younger daughter in the Silicon Valley of California was challenging, to say the least. Entitlement, affluenza, excuse-making, and coddling are the prevalent parenting styles. At the same time, demanding, irrational metrics are used to grade and judge young people on their performance while ignoring the young people's actual strengths and nurturing their gifts and talents. Character formation is not a priority. It does take a village to raise a child, but not in the way in which that phrase is often used. Parents need other adults to support the boundaries, rules, and structure that form a civil society. Parents cannot instill those morals and values in their children when other adults are not only not living those morals and values, but are attempting to interfere with and thwart the parents' attempts to instill those morals and values in their own children. I was twice reported to CPS by the Wellness Center installed at my daughter's public high school, who, by the way, was staffed by an outside organization, not individuals employed by the school district. Why? The first time I told my daughter that lying, cheating, and stealing were not okay. This was non-negotiable. Apparently, this was interpreted as emotional abuse. The worst thing a parent can do in the Silicon Valley is upset their child. The second time I was told, I told my daughter that I didn't believe her, that she had finished her homework because she lied. In fact, she had not finished or even started her homework. This was also interpreted, as emotional abuse. Fortunately, CPS outright dismissed these two reports as not describing emotional abuse. When my daughter's behavior became increasingly unacceptable, we turned to a wilderness program and then Spring Ridge Academy for help. At Spring Ridge Academy, where Ms. Filsinger is a clinical director, instead of help, we got discredited cult methodology and the type of hazing that is no longer being accepted in college fraternities. Our younger daughter was being exposed to all manner of concerning and scary behavior, as well as staff who are, quite simply, unqualified. Even worse, when I discovered this and rescinded my contract with Spring Ridge Academy, Ms. Filsinger created a document without factual basis, as I had never spoken to Ms. Filsinger that I can recall, to be used against me in my family law case where I had primary legal custody and decision making for our younger daughter after a lengthy evaluation and recommendation by a renowned and reputable local custody evaluator, a psychologist who is a member of the American Board of Professional Psychologists, an elite organization. In violation of California law, the family law judge, completely new to our case, ordered my daughter returned to Spring Ridge Academy on an ex parte motion, in other words, without a hearing. In fact, Spring Ridge Academy, a for-profit school, would not be legal in the state of California, as my research revealed. This was all done because my ex-husband, an absent parent with a $250 million trust fund, was paying Spring Ridge Academy $9,000 a month. Spring Ridge Academy's involvement in my family law case continued until I gave up custody in order to have my daughter returned home to live with her father so she would be removed from that environment. And then my ex-husband and Spring Ridge Academy continued some arrangement where my daughter was allegedly being given therapy and schooling remotely. I believe this was a scam, as Spring Ridge Academy has refused to produce any records. What my daughter learned at Spring Ridge Academy is that scammers win in court and that adults who undermine and disparage her ethical, involved, and dedicated mother are not held accountable for their behavior. My daughter's life is in shambles, and I don't know what the future holds for her. Leslie Filsinger has not only violated the basic tenets of her profession, she is a horrible role model for the young women in her care who desperately need ethical adults. And this board is a horrible role model for recommending dismissal of my complaint and failing to hold Leslie Filsinger accountable for her behavior, which is so unacceptable that her own subordinate, Veronica Borges, filed a complaint with the Arizona Residential Facilities Licensing, describing those behaviors that she found concerning, including Leslie Filsinger. Leslie Filsinger has failed my daughter and failed the public, and you, this board, has failed my daughter, and you have failed the public in allowing these types of situations to continue without any action on your part. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Leidy. Do board members have any questions for the complainant? There are no questions. I'd ask that you please mute again. And
I'm going to get off this phone call. It's taken enough time. If you have failed in your obligation, I have spoken my piece. This isn't before a federal court. I thank you for your time today.
Okay.
Anything else? I'm going to be signing off now.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
You and your client have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. We know that you have read all the materials, and we agree with the board's decision to dismiss this matter. So I will leave it at that. Ms. Filsinger did travel here to be present before you today and is happy to answer any questions that the board members may have. But we appreciate your time and consideration.
Ms. Carvis, do board members have any questions for the licensee? No questions? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Dr. Hennigan, I believe this was
Yes, I am in reviewing case. I agree with the recommendation. In this case, that was my colleagues have any questions?
Is that your motion?
Yes, make the motion that we.
Is there a second?
Shen, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you both for being
Thank
here.
You. Thank you.
We'll next go to A2, Ms. Quinlan. And for the record, Ms. Quinlan will be recusing from this matter. She'll take a step away from the table. Complainant can come forward, and I believe we're getting licensed attorney on the phone. Give us 1 second to do that.
Sure.
And for confidentiality's sake, we'll refer to you by your initials, RM. Is that correct? I always like to protect confidentiality.
That, but at this point in time.
Hello, this is Sharon Akins.
Hello, Mr. Akins. This is Patricia, the board's chair.
Hi, Patricia. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. We are getting ready to hear the matter involving Ms. Quinlan. So the board will have a chance to address us, or board staff will have a chance to address us, and then the complainant in this matter is here, so she'll have a chance, and then you and Ms. Quinlan will also have a chance to address us.
Very good. Thank you so much. Are we on the record at this point?
We are. Did you want to introduce yourself and your client?
I can certainly do that. This is Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee, Heidi Quinlan. I'll also let her introduce herself.
And we'll do that once we bring her forward.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, based on licensee's 12-22-20 court appointment in this matter, the board may consider dismissing this complaint pursuant to ARS 3232-81-D1, which gives the board the authority to dismiss complaints that are without merit. Complaints dismissed pursuant to this section cannot be disclosed by the board as a complaint on the licensee's complaint history. And board members, for your review, if you want to take a look at attachment number 5 in this matter, there is a court appointment, and I will just go ahead and read it for the record. Any alleged impropriety or unethical conduct by the appointee shall be brought to the attention of the court in writing prior to the submission of such complaints to any administrative bodies. Professional conduct within the scope of this court shall not be deemed unprofessional conduct by the court or any administrative body. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Bella. Do board members have any questions? You have 5 minutes to address the board.
Hi. Dear board members and public, my name is Robin Mueller. I have a BA, an MA in sociology and counseling, and a master's in social work. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I am a member of this board. So I want to start by addressing the court judicial immunity. It was given in concern was given due to a concern that exposure to liability would deter acceptance of court appointments, color their recommendations, and undermine objectivity and independence. I do not believe at any time judicial immunity was set to not allow for individuals who are not functioning or following the rules and the codes for counselors and social works to be violated and then not to be held accountable for their inappropriate actions and unprofessional conduct. Decisions made by the trial court, Paul E. versus Courtney F., held that treating therapist who performs a non-judicial function does not justify immunity. The court also examined the granting judicial immunity to mental health professionals appointed to provide therapy. They held that treating therapist who performs a non-judicial function does not justify immunity. Reliance on Arizona statute ARS 25-405B, which gives the court the opportunity to seek the advice of professional personnel to justify the appointment, did not withstand scrutiny of the court. The statute did not afford the court the authority to confer immunity to a therapist. Would someone be held accountable for inappropriate actions, not following the code of conduct, and violation of ethics were they not court appointed? This complaint is on Heidi Quinlan, who is a sitting board member. She has had 7 past complaints that I can find on record, which have all been dismissed. I am complaint number 8. But I am sure that there are more in the past records. She has a past record of being disciplined by this board. Thus, I believe she learned that this board to use family court as a way of avoiding being held accountable. When you see a professional in a behavioral health setting, you're looking for help and a safe place to make changes, making things better, and overall improvement. And there should be trust in these individuals because they are licensed and monitored by the state. However, Ms. Quinlan has abused her authority as a therapist, not performed evidence-based therapy, physically assaulted me, lied to the court, and has been fraudulent. I would like to point out Rule 74, as amended, on 5-21-21, that addresses immunity. Letter L, immunity. The parenting coordinator has immunity in accordance with the Arizona law as to all acts taken under the consistent with the court's appointment order. However, M states, complaints about unethical or unprofessional conduct of a parenting coordinator, complaints about alleged unethical or unprofessional conduct by the parenting coordinator should be submitted to the parent coordinator's applicable licensing or regulatory board. If the parenting coordinator is not subject to licensing or regulatory board, the complaint should be brought to the court's attention. Again, Rule 74. It applies to parent coordinators. I have been told by psychologists it applies across to their board as well. So I'd like to point that out. Furthermore, on the part of Ms. Quinlan, who met with me for the third time on March 13, 2021, and reviewed with me the circumstances that caused her to be appointed to my case, which was physical incident between myself and my son during a homeschooling session, which was captured on video. I audio recorded my session with Ms. Quinlan, as there had been verbally threatening things said prior. During the recording, Ms. Quinlan and I viewed the 30-second clip of my altercation with my son. All the while, I am pointing out that my hands were on my son's face to redirect him for a total of 3 seconds in order for him to make eye contact. Ms. Quinlan faced me, wagged her finger in the face, getting loud. She then pushed me back in the chair, proceeded to put her hands around my neck. Ms. Quinlan was audio recorded, putting her hands physically around my throat in a choking motion, which was quite shocking and distressing to me. Ms. Quinlan's physical touch was not consensual, nor was it therapeutic. And I would like everyone to hear exactly what had occurred.
I hate to interrupt, but you do have 1 minute left. So
hopefully we'll come back to that at the end then. because I can verbally say what had happened in that recording, which you guys do have on evidence. She put her hands around my throat, and I am sitting there saying, I did not do that to my son. I did not put my hands around his neck. You put your hands around my neck. She told me it didn't matter where she put her hands. It could be around my neck, on my face, or even on my nose. This was inappropriate behavior by a therapist. I have consulted with many psychologists and many other therapists who have stated at no point in time should a therapist be putting her hands on someone. I should also point out that Ms. Quinlan knew I had past trauma, which was revealed in therapy. Her behavior has not only caused me a severe panic attack that particular day, but needing to go to the urgent care for the pain in my neck. I now have ongoing nightmares as well as continued medical treatment for my neck to this day. I want to make it very clear. I never consented to her touching me in any way and felt powerless to protect myself, stand up for myself, as this person held the promise of me being reunited with my children. After the incident,
I have to ask you to wrap up. I apologize. We've got to give equal time.
I would urge the board to investigate this matter further versus dismissing it. This has been filed with the Mesa Police Department, code number 20211982 75, after speaking with your office and saying that it needs to be dismissed, because I did not understand why someone with an act like this was not being held accountable. And they said it has to be criminal, and therefore it has been called into the police. It has also been filed with Judge Como on a Rule 85. Furthermore, the board should be open to the past reopen the past dismissed cases for review, investigate all incoming complaints, because there are more coming. In addition, the governor should rescind the appointment of Heidi Quinlan to this board. Heidi Quinlan should have her license suspended permanently so that she no longer harms others in such calculated acts. I would like to attempt one more time to share the...
I have to stop there because I've let you go over 2 minutes. Let me see if board members have any questions.
Sure.
Do board members have any questions for the... I do have to ask you.
You understand we would hear the case if you received relief from the court. We just.
But you do not need relief from the court. According to Rule 74, it can still be brought in front of the board. Hopefully, your AG will investigate that further and realize that you are not following the statute of the law.
Okay.
And I'm asking you to follow the statute of the law, regardless of a Rule 85.
Thank you. So I just want to make sure you understood why we were not hearing that today.
Do board members have any other questions at this time? I'd ask that you take your seat. Ms. Quinlan, if you could come forward, please. And if you could introduce yourself to the record, please.
Heidi Quinlan.
Ms. Quinlan, Mr. Akins, you have up to I will give you up to 7 minutes to address the board, the same amount that the complainant had.
I have no comments at this point. I don't believe that Ms. Quinlan does either, but I'll let her speak for herself, please.
No, I have no comments.
Do board members have any questions for Ms. Quinlan? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. Request that you not interrupt. I would like to make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice. Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? We'll be going into executive session at 9:33.
This is Farron Akins.
Hi, Mr. Akins. This is Patricia with the board.
Hi there.
We're back on the record in open session, and I believe this is going to move us into our deliberations. So we ask that you not interrupt. And, Doc, I believe this was your case.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members of the board, Madam Chair, this is a difficult case, difficult situation. We have precedent, we have a court order, and I feel as though if we follow the court order and respect precedent, we can appropriately dispose of this case. But I'd like to give my colleagues an opportunity to speak.
That's what we've done in the past, and we have had complainants go to the court and seek relief and come back to the board, and we were given the court's permission to investigate, and the investigation moved forward. So there's nothing that stops the complainant from filing the complaint with, after going to the court and seeking relief from the court.
And unless my colleagues disagree, the order of the court is an order that we have to respect as well. And we have our rules that we have to follow. So I'm not always thrilled, but I follow the rules. So unless there's any further discussion, looking, seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to move that we dismiss this case.
Is there a second?
There is a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Mueller, for being here, Ms. Quinlan, and Mr. Akins. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
And we will be moving on to consent agenda. Let's see, 4A3, and I believe we are getting the complainant, no, the licensee and attorney are present, and we're getting the complainant on the phone. Is that correct? Okay. And Ms. Quinlan has rejoined us. I was just kidding. We are going to take a short break. So we are going to take a break, come back at 10:15.
Sorry.
That's all right. Thanks for the exercise.
All right, we're coming back to order. It is 10:17. For the record, Ms. Quinlan is not rejoining us for the remainder of the meeting. Mr. Carey, if you want to introduce yourself and your client for the record, please.
Yes, Chair Dobratz, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for licensee.
Julie Wansowitz Moore, LPC.
And then we're getting the complainant on the phone.
Reach 1-520-231-69.
We could try one more time for the record.
Hi, you've reached one.
Madam Chair, for the record, the complainant is the one that pulled this matter, and the complainant was aware that we're going to be calling this number after 9 o'clock this morning. We've attempted twice with no answer, so I would consider that the members consider moving forward with this matter.
All right. Mr. Carey, I assume you do not wish to address the board without the complainant.
Well, given that he appears to have waived his choice to pull it, I think it's back on. I think you can put it back on consent and vote it as a consent item.
Is there a motion to dismiss?
Davis moves it.
Bailey second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We will now move to agenda item 4B. And these are cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Again, I'll read the matters to see if there is anybody here who wishes to have the case pulled, meaning that you wish to address the board. B1, Annette Vlad, is anybody here to pull that matter and address the board? And my understanding, we have pulled B2, Mr. Russo. Is the licensee here?
Yes, we are.
Okay, I just wanted to see who was present. And we will have the complainant on the phone for that matter.
That is correct.
B3, Mr. Rios, anybody here to pull that matter? All right, is there a motion to dismiss with a letter of concern for B1 and B3?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Ending in second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And so we will hear B2, Mr. Russo's matter. Do you want to come forward now? And I believe we are getting the complainant and another participant who wishes to speak on the matter, correct?
Welcome to Loom. Thank you. Welcome to Lumen Conferencing. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound or hash key, and I'll connect you. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the third person to join the meeting.
Mr. Cross, Ms. Russell, are you there?
I'm here.
Yes, I'm
this
here.
This is Keith Cross.
Great. Thank you both. This is Patricia, the board's chairperson, and we are getting ready to hear Mr. Russo's matter. How we'll proceed is board staff will have a chance to address the board, and then the two of you collectively as the complainant and an interested party will have up to 5 minutes to address the board or equal time that it takes the board to present, whichever is greater. And then the licensee and his attorney will have a chance to address the board. So at this time, I'd ask that you both mute until we're ready to hear from you. And if the licensee and counsel would please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson. I'm Gary Fidel, counsel for Dr. Vincent Russo.
Good morning, Dr. Vincent Russo.
Thank you both. And is there a summary from board staff?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter was originally placed on the consent agenda based on board staff's recommendation. After the report went out and
complainant was notified that this was on the consent agenda for dismiss with a letter of concern. We did receive some additional information from the intern, and based on that and just my review of the case, I felt that it would be important that we pull the matter so that it be heard by each and every board member here. With that said, I do know that it has been assigned to Mr. Shen. But going back to the purpose of the letter of concern was in regards to following a review of the investigative record. It didn't appear to rise to the level of disciplinary action. However, the board may want to consider a letter of concern. That is attachment number 6, and it would be due to the licensee's failure to maintain a professional decorum in a behavioral health setting based on licensee's acknowledgement that he made the following comments to intern. Quote, I see where you get your looks from. You look just like your mother, end quote. End quote, if things were different, I'd be your stepfather, end quote. Quote, dad has only one syllabi and licensee has 4, end quote. Based on the additional information that was uploaded to the member portal, we did get some additional information from the intern in regards to third-party, actually witnesses to comments that were made. And in review of that supplement, the interview of the director denied hearing that the licensee inappropriately called the intern an inappropriate name. However, the owner did conclude and verify that the licensee did make comments in regards to the intern's mother. Again, that's why I pulled it from the consent agenda so that it would be reviewed from the members. And that's all I have unless you have questions for me.
Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? Mr. Cross, Ms. Russell, again, collectively you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. So I don't know if one of you wants to go first or how you want to allocate that time.
I think I'm going to first comment. First, I want to sincerely thank the board for hearing this matter. I recognize you have the information and my testimony of the events that occurred while I was under Dr. Russo's supervision, so I won't go into detail. I do want to say that what prompted me to speak today is the fact that I don't believe Dr. Russo's actions would change if he's not held accountable. On two occasions, he did comment on his actions and words. These comments came the day after the occurrence and in the form of excuses. So the porn being on his computer, this is that his grandson messed with his stuff. For making the joke about hearing that his excuse was because his filter was low that day. And just to me, these excuses indicate that he knew his actions and words were neither ethical nor professional. However, there was never an apology or question of if and how his actions may have impacted me. And then for him to feel so comfortable speaking freely about his thoughts and opinions on my mother's physical appearance, I think exemplified his lack of awareness and concern. Again, this is why I believe that accountability is important in this matter, and as counseling professionals, we're ethically and legally obligated to be aware of the impact of our words and actions. And by the time I decided to leave Blueprints, I was very uncomfortable and believed that, you know, his actions would continue. It just didn't feel like a safe place for me to continue my internship. And thank you for your time and for hearing this matter, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Russell. Mr. Cross, did you have anything you'd like to add?
Yes, I would, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you again for giving us this time, to share our thoughts about the case. I'll skip some of my comments. It sounds like what Ms. Zavala had summarized hit some of the points that I was unsure about. What I will focus on, though, is the 3232.51.16aa definition of sexual harassment does mention, quote, unwelcome comments or gestures or any other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. And I want to kind of hone in on that the piece about the unwelcome comments or gestures and how I understand we need to provide clear and convincing evidence of that, but it's kind of difficult to to provide essentially proof of a feeling or an experience. Despite that, Ms. Russell had significant implications related to leaving her internship placement in the middle of her final semester, potentially missing the minimum number of hour requirements for the course, potentially resulting in a failing grade, and at a minimum, delaying her graduation. Ultimately couldn't endure Dr. Russo's behavior and chose to drop her internship placement. I'm not an attorney. I'm just a professional counseling, but I tell you what, this feels to me like clear and convincing evidence that it was unwelcomed. If she's willing to, risk all of that to leave the site given Dr. Russo's behavior, I don't know how else you could define unwelcomed. There's all kinds of other implications that I won't get into related to finding another site, going through the full process of applying for another placement through the program. But that ultimately her experience was one that essentially it was enough. It was so unwelcomed that she was willing to risk all that to leave. So in this case, it sounds like we do have one person acknowledging, witnessing one instance of sexual harassment. The other person is apparently denying it. But in my opinion, we're talking about, again, for the unwelcome comments or gestures, which is written into statute as, as unwelcomed, that in this case, I think it's pretty clear that Ms. Russell's behavior demonstrates that it was unwelcomed. And my fear is that ultimately a non-disciplinary letter of concern will send the wrong message to the licensees in the state of Arizona, a message that is clearly contrary to the values and ethics of our respective positions. But again, thank you for letting us take a few minutes to share our thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you. Do board members have any questions for Mr. Cross? Dr. Russo, you have up to 6 minutes to address the board now.
Thank you, members of the board. I think I will go first. The first thing I want to tell you is compliment the investigative staff for the report, the thoroughness of the report. It appears that staff went down every row that it felt it needed to, interview the appropriate individuals, continue to provide members of the board with information as late as possible. So Dr. Russo and I appreciate the thoroughness of it and really the even-handed nature of the report. Spelled it out and set it out for all of us to review. And obviously, from my standpoint as Dr. Russo's attorney, I agree with no clear and convincing evidence upon which Dr. Russo should be disciplined, the nature of everything that's happened. And the key points, it seems to me, let's get real about it, the issue of the pornography, that issue was run down and it determined there was no evidence of that. The use of the term slut, folks were interviewed, statements were given, no evidence that was used other than the intern's statement. And with all due respect, that's your job to decide under the circumstances whether to accept that version as being credible. And the other aspect, I think, that's clear to me is, yes, there is the section of the statute dealing with sexual harassment. Comments that were made that Dr. Russo acknowledged kind of fall into that gray area. I mean, essentially, probably made Ms. Russell feel uncomfortable, and under the circumstances, one could say, okay, anything of that nature might be classically defined as sexual harassment. Ultimately, Dr. Russo has acknowledged he made those statements. Had inside his head what was going on at the time he made those statements. The last thing that I do want to point out, and I'll let Dr. Russo finish up, and that is
this complaint has come to you in a somewhat mysterious nature. In other words, Dr. Cross filed the complaint. It appears at the time Ms. Russell was not interested in filing the complaint in her own name. Now, Ms. Russell is here. So I think under the circumstances, I'm coming here suggesting to you that in your deliberation, certainly to decide a letter of concern is appropriate. Really no basis to say, how did you all ever get that result? But in terms of a bell-shaped curve, this is one of those cases that probably right on the border of dismissal versus a letter of concern. So we would encourage you to consider a straight dismissal as an alternative to what we have. So thank you.
Dr. Russo, anything you would add?
Again, thank you for your time. I can tell you that I've learned a great deal from this, that I learned I need to be more vigilant and less flippant. My intention was never malicious or worse. I realized that my staff needs a supervisor, not a friend. And all the other things that have happened, I think I can easily correct that. I don't believe I'll have a situation like this pop up again.
Do board members have any questions?
I do have one question. Can you just speak to this? It's a little bit different than what we've been talking about here for the last few minutes, but can you speak to why you thought it was appropriate to ask your other supervisee to write a letter on your behalf?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Why you thought it was appropriate to ask your other supervisee to write a letter on your behalf?
Well, I believe I only wrote one supervisee who came out at the same time as Ms. Williams, and I asked her if she had any concerns with me, offered her several times if she wanted a new supervisor. I even offered my resignation to my owner. She said that she did not want a new supervisor and that she would be willing to write a letter stating what she stated. And so it wasn't so much solicited as agreed upon.
Okay, so the bottom, have you read the letter?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so at the bottom it says, without coercion or implied threat, Dr. Russo did approach me to ask me if I could write a letter for him, of which I'm happy to do.
Right.
This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
So I would love an open discussion with my peers on this. But, you know, to be honest, I waxed and waned a little bit on this one. And initially, you know, didn't see a lot of significant evidence for the behavior. However, you know, the licensee did acknowledge that these behaviors occurred, right? And my concern is that any professional in this field needs to understand that anything you say in a joking manner can impact those around you. But it's very basic. The supplemental information, though, is really where my perspective has changed a little bit. And the reason why is that there is an individual who has acknowledged that they did, you know, see this behavior occur. And they did acknowledge that these comments were made. So to say that there's really no evidence isn't true anymore. There is evidence there. So before I make a motion, because I have something that I have finally become comfortable with, I want to hear from my peers anything else you'd like to add to the conversation.
Effect.
What you say, I mean, it's how you mean it. We all have so much
Uh,
that I want to note and not necessarily that they impact. I apologize, but I think it, on the record, to address counsel, there were two comments made. One was about the credibility concern and that our job is to judge credibility, which is true, but we're also looking at, do we have clear and convincing evidence? And so I just want to make it very clear that even if we dismiss the letter of concern, that does not mean that we don't find concern to be credible. So I think that's an important distinction. The other was the comment regarding who filed the complaint. At the end of the day, Mr. Cross has an obligation, if he believes there was unprofessional conduct, to file a complaint. And we all know that interns just entering this field, it's very compromising position for them to be in. And so the fact that the intern did file a complaint, in my opinion, doesn't bear weight on the matter. So I just think those are important things to put on the record.
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. I'm impressed with how difficult it can be to remain totally arm's length, professional distance from everybody. Having been in the field for over 40 years, it is so different and so difficult to be that perfect senior professional. And when I reviewed the material, and I thought, okay, dismiss with a letter of concern, don't do that. But that's as far as I felt it should go, and I admit it. I'll respect the opinions of my peers, but I think that I'm glad that some of the things that we experience cause us to become stronger and more resilient. And I think that in the field, one of the characteristics that I most appreciate is the resiliency that I have been able to develop over the last 50 years. I am grateful, but I understand that many people coming into the field don't have it yet. So I respect it, but I definitely feel like a dismissal with a letter of concern is appropriate and sufficient.
I have a tiny bit of a different opinion. I'll just go ahead and share. I just, in light of what was said, Doc, I appreciate your comments. Because we have to think through so much. And when our head is in a different place and we think something's going to be just kind, maybe humorous, maybe,
right,
you know, lighthearted.
Yes.
It, and then we maybe hear it or hear how somebody took that, and then we have a different feeling about it. I understand that. The comment, though, that was made feels really inappropriate. And I'm just uncomfortable with that, with the actual content of what was said. I'm additionally concerned with two things. One was the letter being approached. I'm just super concerned with the lack of thought on the power differential between a supervisor and not only your supervisee, but an intern. We know that interns do not know.
Mm-hmm.
And we want them to have a good experience starting out. And I just think that's super important. And so we have this comment being made. We have a solicitation of a letter, you know, by another intern. And then today, the comment of, I now know that they need a supervisor, not a friend. And that just does not, it's just not sitting well with what I already had, right? It just kind of just supported where I was going, that this just doesn't feel good. So I wasn't leaning, though, into an NDCA. I think there's only because I have some education in mind that I would like to see that I think would be helpful and show that we took the matter seriously, but maybe didn't rise to the level of a
judge. Everything that you had just mentioned is kind of where I was going. I didn't see the egregiousness of the behavior. I don't approve of the behavior in any way. And I hold
every professional in this profession to a very high standard. And when I hear a professional who engages in behavior that could make others uncomfortable, it's pretty upsetting to me, to be quite honest. And to use the licensee's own word that he used today in needing to be less flippant. Well, that word is resonating for me, because flippant tells me that you are probably saying other things and maybe engaging in behaviors that do cross that boundary of that therapeutic supervisory relationship versus we're friends, let's hang out. And I think, too, asking a supervisee to write a letter for you, as Dr. Bailey had mentioned, is crossing that line. Because if you're comfortable enough to go and ask for that type of, make that request, then you are intentionally violating that boundary of supervisor supervisee. So with that being said, I also was going to move for an NCDA with education.
Second, Trotter.
Could I clarify that? Just was that six CEUs and sexual harassment?
Did we already?
Oh, we didn't get to that yet.
Yeah, because we were making a motion before.
Oh.
He wants to know if everyone's on board with an NCDA.
Oh, okay.
And
I'm
then
sorry.
If they are, then we'll move forward.
I thought somebody made, I heard motion.
Oh, no. So I move that we offer it.
You're saying that we need to discuss?
Well, if you motion, usually there's a discussion of what the education looks like, and then there'd be a motion to offer a consent agreement for 12 months for.
Or NDCA.
Their consent agreement require them to take a certain amount of CEUs in a certain topic.
Oh,
more to
oh.
The motion.
Gotcha.
Like with discipline where we do the vote for finding the violation.
Gotcha.
I think they were taking it.
Yes.
Gotcha. So.
So I think education on boundaries is definitely necessary. Education regarding the supervisory relationship. Sexual harassment, I think, would be part of that as well, and anything else my peers would want to see.
The focus on the power differential.
I'm just going to put this out there. I would recommend that we ask him to take the 12-hour class over again for supervisors.
Oh.
It goes over the boundaries. It goes over what our role is as supervisors, the stage of training for interns versus associates, where they're at in the associate versus getting for licensure. I'm hoping that it would, you know, address, I remember addressing some ethics and whatnot. I'm not opposed to other things on top of that, but I believe Dr. Russo has been a supervisor for quite some time, and for the renewals, we do a six-hour and a three-hour tutorial with the board, and if we're still in this spot, I think we need to go back and add that other 6 hours, which talks about what it means to be a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my recommendation.
Yeah. Agreed. Would, going back to Doc, would a training on the supervisor relationship include power differential?
It would. I've taken that course, and
okay.
Yes, it
okay.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
The 12-hour clinical supervisor during those initial,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Initial
and then I think specifically. Yeah. Agreed.
Three.
I think three is okay.
So what I heard then, we would be offering the licensee a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. He would be required to complete the 12 CEUs in clinical supervision as well as 3 CEUs in sexual harassment. If not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Is that your motion?
So moved.
Potter, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Cross. Thank you, Ms. Russell, for participating, and thank you both for being here. This will conclude this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and we will move to 4C, our cases recommended for release from consent agreements. Is there anybody here who wishes to pull a matter from 4C? Is there a motion to release from the consent agreement C1 through 6?
Davis moves it.
Trotter, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And that'll bring us to 4D, our cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Is there a motion to do so for D1 and D2?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Second, Trotter.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Go to 4G, our case is recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. G1, is there anybody here who wishes to pull Ms. McCullough's case? G2, Mr. Rush's case, Rush's case? You wish to pull it and address the board? All right. Are you the complainant or the professional? The complainant? All right. We will take G2 first then, if you want to come forward. All right, and could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
My name is Sean Coffey.
And we will first hear a brief summary from board staff, and then we'll give you a chance to address the board.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I just, for full disclosure, I think we have met at one time at a restaurant, your husband, Chip, right?
Yes.
So I think we met, and I just wanted to, full disclosure, that affects my ability to listen to this case.
And transparency, I believe that is the same for me now that you mention it, and I don't believe it impacts my judgment either. So thank you. And the licensee is not here. Ms. Carvis, are you representing? All right. We'll hear a brief summary from board staff first.
Madam Chair, members of the board, given the areas of concern identified in the investigative report, board staff contacted licensee to discuss the option of entering into a non-disciplinary consent agreement, which would specify the following. Although the information provided is not of sufficient seriousness to merit direct action against him, the board is issuing an NDCA based on licensee's concerning conduct. Within 12 months, licensee shall complete 3 clock hours of continuing education addressing cultural diversity, and that NDCA is attached SMIT number 5 for board members' review. Unless you have any questions, that is all that I have for you at this time.
Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? Happy you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
I'd like to thank the board for the opportunity to speak today. I made a complaint regarding Joshua Reich due to his violation of his professional ethics, which places him in violation of Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiner statutes. Specifically, Joshua Reich violated ARS 3232-5116D, making any false, fraudulent, or deceptive statement connected with the practice of behavioral health, including false or misleading advertising by the licensee or the licensee's staff or a representative compensated by the licensee. He did this by placing in his profile on Psychology Today, Find a Therapist, that one of his client focuses was bisexual, gay, and lesbian peoples. The reason that he denied me and my spouse services was, as he indicated by text, and I quote, "Thanks for contacting me about therapy. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to take you and your husband as a couple as it goes against my faith." Interestingly, it has only been within the last couple of weeks that he removed his deceptive listing of working with bisexual, gay, and lesbian clients. Joshua Reich also is in violation of ARS 3232-5116K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client. Excuse me. Specifically, Joshua Reich failed to follow the recognized standard outlined in the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy Code of Ethics, which states, as their very first standard, standards, responsibilities to clients. 1.1, non-discrimination. Marriage and family therapists provide professional assistance to persons without discrimination on the basis of race, age, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, disability, gender, health status, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, or relationship status. When Joshua Reich placed misleading advertising in his profile and refused service to my spouse and I, he did willfully violate board statutes. I do not like that the board is entertaining entering into a non-disciplinary consent agreement with Joshua Reich. I do believe that the board is acting in a manner that is expedient for the board. The non-disciplinary consent agreement allows the board to appear to take action when truly it is not. Again, expedient for the board, but not safe for the public. I firmly believe, had this been a violation of professional ethics and board statutes that was based on discrimination due to race, age, ethnicity, religion, or national origin, the findings and recommended actions would have been different. At a minimum, the professional would have had a consent agreement that included a graduate level course in ethics. We all know that while the consent agreement will appear in records that action was taken on Joshua Reich's license, it will also reflect that it was non-disciplinary. When a person violates professional ethics and thereby violates Arizona board statutes by discriminating, there should be disciplinary action taken. If no disciplinary action is taken and there are no consequences to his discriminatory actions, he will believe that he has the board's endorsement to continue these behaviors. How does this protect the public? So as you consider your vote regarding this matter to issue a non-disciplinary consent agreement to Joshua Reich, think about this. Are you Dr. DeBratz, and are you Dr. Bailey, as licensed marriage and family therapists, upholding the ethics of the AAMFT? And to each of you as board members, think about whether you are upholding the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health statutes by not making Joshua Reich accountable for his actions. I ask you, in the words of author Emily P. Freeman, do the next right thing now. Not the big thing, not the impressive thing, just the next right thing in front of us. I am open to any questions.
Board members have any questions? I'd ask that you take your seat so Ms. Carvis can come forward. Ms. Carvis, you're appearing on behalf of your client, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Mandy Carvis of Wickersmith appearing on behalf of my client, Joshua Reich. We were not informed that this matter was going to be pulled, so Mr. Reich is not appearing before you today. I know that you've reviewed all of the materials, so I'll just keep my comments brief, as I believe that the resolution that we have worked out with the board is appropriate under the circumstances. Mr. Reich obviously understands that this situation could have been handled in a much better and more sensitive way. The appropriate thing would have just been to say, I can assist you and provide other resources as to someone who could assist him. It is, however, statutorily protected under ARS 41419304-5B that he may make business-related decisions in accordance with sincerely held religious beliefs. That right has also been upheld by the Arizona Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. However, my client does realize that it was insensitive in the manner in which he handled it, and he would not choose to handle such a thing going forward. He has changed his profile on Psychology Today to remove any confusing advertising. The only reason that he waited for a while to do that is he didn't want it to appear that he was doing so improperly after receipt of a complaint. Once I told him that it was okay to do that and that it was suggested and appropriate to do that, he took care of it immediately, and that has been corrected and rectified. He's already learned an immense amount from this situation. I'm sure he will learn even more from the recommended coursework, and we would ask that the board members accept the NDCA that has been presented and accepted. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Carvis? Thank you. This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves.
I read through a few times, right? You want to make sure that you're not missing anything, and you know your own thoughts on what does this mean and what does this mean. You know, I appreciate Mr. Coffey's comment, you know, they're my ethics too, right? And then I also know that we are trying to find good fits, right, and what we're competent, what we're skilled, whatever our religious beliefs, I can't tell anyone to do anything against that, I don't feel. I feel that would be the opposite side of that. So it is kind of a delicate manner. But in light of the obvious comment made, and in light of, you know, even Mr. Coffey's, you know, statements of the statutes, you know, I do agree that, you know, this was not handled well. And it was, you know, there was a lack of sensitivity on how to present maybe what his reasons were or whatever that meant. So I did find that the report is appropriate and the outcome is appropriate. I'm in support of that. I would like to see the CEU number of units, though, be increased to 6. And I would like to go, and personally, so I'm not making a motion, but I'm just letting you guys all know, I'd like to go on record encouraging the licensee to find something that is supportive of some collegial dialogue on how to handle the idea of finding a good fit and where our skill level is and competency and how to appropriately display that to the public and or callers calling in. So I hope he takes advantage of that.
I had a really hard time when I read it because we cited AAMFT, Code of Ethics, like just glaring in the back of my mind, and the statute that, you know, as a professional you also have the right. It is your so it wasn't necessarily taking that stance, but it was advertising your services essentially as an ally. Our number one obligation as a professional is to do no harm. And I feel like if you present yourself and you create an environment where somebody feels they can reach out to you.
Agreed.
And then you slap in the face and you handle it the way that was handled. So that was really interesting. Wanted to note that. Back and forth. So in terms of discipline versus.
I was that as, I guess, a public member. To my knowledge, at least, Psychology Today is kind of like the primary or like a very big source in your community, professional community, when it comes to advertising your services. So to me, like you said, you know, you have the right, but I think it was very just unprofessional and kind of just for professionals in this space to have that much education and to not understand that basic point that, you know, your field is, you know, human emotion, understanding, and it seems like there's a complete lack of understanding from this professional. So while, you know, I do agree with, you know, with the future recommendation, I'm just disappointed, and I don't, I guess I just want to put that on record, you know, there is a balance in this, and it seems like there can be balances on two different sides here, but to me, he was just completely lacking the understanding of putting that on and then running into the situation and be like, well, you know, NDCA, but that's not necessarily right. So I just want to, I guess, you know, put my point on record that I don't necessarily want professionals in the future I want professionals in the future to learn from this, you know. Advertise correctly. You can see what you want to see, but just advertise correctly. And advertising incorrectly on Psychology Today is very poor, and it's just, it's just lacking what you should be doing as a professional.
And that reminded me of my second point that I have forgotten. But also, when you're advertising as a licensed marriage and family therapist, you should assume that somebody looking at your profile thinks that that applies to marriage and family therapy. So it applies to working with couples and families versus perhaps another discipline. And so the assumption that if you're listing yourself open to working certain populations, you should assume that those populations, including their partners and families.
I always find it interesting when a religious exemption is claimed for exclusionary behavior, when in many religions, the exemplar of those religions was not an exclusionary individual. So I find myself working with that daily.
Okay. So I'll just see how a vote goes. I'll just go. Is that okay if I just move that we?
So what I would ask you to do if you want to up this the CEUs basically would be offer an NDCA. Mm-hmm. So we'd be offering the licensee consent agreement for 12, a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. You'd be required to complete 6 CEUs in cultural diversity, and if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal interview.
So moved.
And just the word cultural, the phrase cultural diversity, I found it very interesting to study cultural humility recently. So if that were the choice by that professional, that I would find that to be acceptable as well.
Okay. Motion or for a second?
Second, Trotter.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And that will bring us back to G1. Ms. McAuliffe, I don't believe anybody was here to pull that matter. But I do need to recuse, so Mr. Davis will be having the vote on this one.
Thank you. And again, I don't see anyone present looking to pull that case. So is there any discussion among the board members? Then I move that we accept the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement.
Bailey, second.
Thank you. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Thank you very much. The motion passes. We will welcome our esteemed chairperson back.
Thank you, Doc. All right. That will conclude our consent agenda. Let's take a short break. It is 11:06, and we will come back to hear our disciplinary matters at 11:15. All right. We will go back on the record at 11:16, and we are going to agenda item number 7. Our complaints and disciplinary matters. We will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given to us by ARS 323281. Please be aware that we've read all of the materials submitted for each case, and during the course of the meeting, if it is necessary to refer to clients, please only use initials, and that includes a complainant, which may be a client as well. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach the deliberations phase. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options the board considers. The board will first hear a brief summary of the case from board staff. Once that is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional, will be given an opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity, we ask those speaking not take time repeating information that the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, collectively will be given time to address the board equal to the time it took the board staff to present the investigative report, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Please keep in mind that the board has a civility policy that prohibits the use of any type of disorderly conduct. Those violating the policy will be removed from the meeting room. Once the board concludes its discussions with the parties, we'll move into our deliberations. While the parties are free to stay and listen, we ask that you respect that this is our time to talk amongst ourselves and not interrupt that process. We will first go to 7F. Ms. Swisher, is the complainant present? Do you wish to address the board? Okay. If you would please come forward. And then is the licensee and counsel present? And if you want to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Patsy Hernandez.
And we're going to first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, the matters before the board for review, consideration, and possible action regarding accepting the proposed signed consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the professional's license. On 9/14/21, the board received a complaint of unprofessional conduct alleging licensee was having a sexual relationship with clients. Due to the egregiousness of the complaint, board staff reached out to licensee.
Attachment two is the proposed consent agreement for admitting to having a sexual relationship with a former client. And that's all I have unless you have further questions for me.
Do board members have any questions? You would have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay, thank you. A client walks into a therapist's office after being diagnosed with ADHD, depression, bipolar, and suicidal thoughts, and vulnerable and needing help. A bond begins between the client and therapist. There is a trust between the two. It is unethical for the therapist and client to have any kind of relations or have feelings for each other. The therapist is supposed to stop therapy when this happens, when feelings are involved. This is a conflict of interest. It is wrong when a therapist takes advantage of the client. What kind of therapist has an outside relationship with the client, knowing that person is mentally unstable? The client came home to tell me that they are hanging out, meeting for coffee, hiking every week, 4 months after the client's last session due to insurance change. The therapist was not covered on that new insurance plan. The therapist's actions were wrong. This is unethical. The therapist stepped her boundaries. Brooke Swisher should have her license revoked so this does not happen to someone else. Brooke has a role and should not be allowed to work with vulnerable people. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just clarify something for the complainant, just because I think a voluntary surrender is something that we're used to hearing, but just for the record, a voluntary surrender is considered a revocation, so I just want you to know that.
This will be our time to deliberate, and Mr. Trotter, I believe this was your story.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, given the evidence, I believe we should just accept the voluntary surrender of the license as the proposed consent agreement. That's about it. Thank you. Accepted.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you for being here. Thank you for filing this.
Thank you.
Go to 7C, Mr. Kinsey. I believe, Mr. Carey, you are appearing on behalf.
I am.
Is the complainant present? And if you would introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Chair Dobratz, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Kinsey.
Dr. Vincent Kinsey.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're first going to hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, it is not apparent whether there is clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following section of the ACA Code of Ethics. A6B, extending counseling boundaries. Factors to consider. From December 2020 to July 2021, licensee provided behavioral health services to client. Licensee acknowledges the client picked up wheelchair batteries for licensee. Licensee represents the following regarding the batteries. Client offered to pick up the batteries since the store would be closed by the time licensee finished his day. Licensee accepted the offer as a simple act of kindness. Licensee prepaid the store for the batteries. It was not appropriate, and licensee made a bad decision. Additionally, although licensee represents the client did not build a patio for licensee, the following admissions are problematic. Licensee may have discussed renovations to licensee's patio. Licensee asked client for ideas. Client showed licensee some pictures of projects he did to his own backyard. Client gave licensee advice on how to put pillars in the ground for a patio. Discussions client and licensee had in regards to renovations were after the session and in casual conversation. By allowing client to pick up the batteries for licensee, as well as having discussions and getting advice from client regarding home renovation projects, licensee may have extended the counseling relationship beyond conventional boundaries. On October 6, 2021, licensee provided board staff with the following certificates of completion: boundaries in psychotherapy and counseling, and the NASW staying out of trouble. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 323251P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board with respect to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record, financial and billing records, and telepractice. Licensee's consent for treatment for client was missing numerous required elements. Additionally, client's consent for treatment was dated July 22, 2021, despite services beginning in December of 2020. Licensee represented the following regarding the consent for treatment. Licensee had to have client sign his consent forms again because he was unable to locate his file. When licensee located his files, his consent forms were missing. The original forms would have been signed after the third session because when licensee first meets a client, licensee does not take the case. If licensee chooses to treat them, then he gives them the consent forms. Although client's January 2021 treatment plan was signed by client and licensee, client did not sign the treatment plan revision section. Client's progress notes were also missing several required elements, as well as telehealth sessions missing several required elements. Although wife attended at least two sessions with client, licensee did not prepare any collateral documentation for wife. Licensee's billing records for client included the following issues. After review of licensee's billing records by board staff, licensee determined he erroneously billed one session that did not occur. Additionally, there appear to be several sessions that licensee did not submit for billing. Licensee represented the following to board staff. Licensee confirmed all of his progress notes are formatted like client's progress notes. Wife did not sign any documentation because licensee did not think about it, and it was a common courtesy. Licensee did not explain wife's role in therapy, licensee's role, or information regarding wife's rights. It is problematic that licensee has been independently licensed for nearly two decades and is currently in private practice, but appears to have been unaware of several basic documentation requirements. Since receiving this board complaint, licensee has taken the following remedial measures. Licensee submitted updated documentation templates that appear to meet minimum board requirements. Additionally, in September of 2021, licensee represented he signed up for continuing education record-keeping course. That's all board staff has, unless you have any questions for us.
Are there any questions? Mr. Carey, you and your client have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
I will have Dr. Kinsey address the board first.
Good morning, members. Good morning. I work with veterans. I'm a retired veteran myself, and I came out of retirement to work with veterans. And I see veterans who come back suffering from PTSD, MST, depression, and anxiety, and I try to meet them where they're at. Veterans are kind of slow to converse with people. They don't trust people, and they have this thing they don't want to deal with anyone. And a lot of them suffer in silence. So when I say I meet them where they're at, I give them an opportunity without rushing them to just open up. When I was working with this particular veteran, he came to me. And I noticed how he was just, I want to say, demoralized and disheartened. And he often expressed how he felt depressed and hopeless. And as the therapy continued, he seemed to open up more. And as I continued to work with him, during the end of our sessions, he would talk about a lot of things. And it seemed to empower him when he talked about these things. And one of them was how he built things in his backyard, the things he did. So I went with that conversation because to me it empowered him. It made him feel good. The batteries, I'm a veteran, he's a veteran. We walked out of my office one day. He heard me on the phone. He said, "Doc, I'll go pick up the batteries." The place was like a half a mile from my office. I said, "Thank you," without thinking. That was my mistake. Won't happen again. But as far as him building anything for me or building a patio, we've never discussed that. I looked at the pictures he showed me on his phone of he built a ramp. He built a portable toilet. He was talking about installing some kind of ramp in his van. I entertained the conversation. I did it because I felt like it uplifted his spirit and it empowered him. But we never discussed him building anything in my backyard or on any of my property. Never happened. That's all I have to say.
And just briefly, Madam Chair, members of the board, I would note that I think he was very direct with the investigator concerning the battery situation. What happened with this is the complaint was filed by the therapist of the wife of the client. So there is an element of telephone that got played here, unfortunately. We've sent you sufficient evidence. I think there is no patio building, and I do think that he did use this as an opportunity to empower the client because the client's wife had a degenerative disease, which is incurable, and the client started to build ramps and things like that as a way of sort of taking control of being able to connect with his wife at a different level than he had been able to. And so I think it was well within the standard of care for Dr. Kinsey to have run with that and used that as a way to have communicated. I think the charting and his discussions with the investigator make it clear that once the veteran opened up, he redirected into the areas of treatment for that veteran. I would suggest he has cured the documentation issues. He's attended staying out of trouble with Ms. Waterman, formerly of the board. He has done other continuing education units. I would ask the board to consider an NDCA, and the reason I'm suggesting that is the deviation on the batteries. While a deviation is not a deviation of some of the boundary violations this board often sees, and also the NDCA does allow documentation. I think because he's completed staying out of trouble, he's completed education, you could also consider a letter of concern, which provides a level of documentation here. I think he has cured the issues, and I think that there is an opportunity here to give him the chance to continue the good work he's doing with veterans. So that would be our request, is to contemplate an LLC. If there feels to be a need of public documentation, then an NDCA. But I don't think the deviation that occurred here was malicious or with the purpose of exploitation. So I would ask for some consideration on a non-disciplinary outcome. And as always, we're here for questions.
Thank you both. Are there questions from board members?
So I want to acknowledge, Dr. Kinsey, that you had, submitted your certificates for completion of a boundaries course and also completion of the NASW staying out of trouble course. And I just was wondering, based off of what you learned in those trainings, would you have done anything different?
Oh, yes. I would have done a lot different. I created my forms myself from the statutes, but I didn't put enough in there. So given that, yeah, I learned a lot from it.
And what about in terms of the battery?
The battery, yes. But it was an honest mistake, and I own it. I said yes without even thinking about it. I really did, but it will never happen again.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
This was. Based off of the information from the board report, what was presented today, I agree. I didn't see any malintent. I don't believe this licensee was you know, made a decision. It was a lapse in judgment in the moment, right? And there was no long-term benefit from this client that he was serving. So, you know, I also don't really see concerns regarding talking about building a patio. I mean, let's be honest, right? As therapists, rapport building sometimes means talking about things that are kind of random.
Right?
Right. Things that you're like, oh, interesting, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and by the time you get in your office, though, you're talking about therapy. So I don't see any concerns with that. I think it's great that this client finds great pride and comfort in talking about the things he's able to accomplish. So I saw it more as, let me show you what I'm very proud of. With all that being said, you know, I think that what this brought into question for me was, okay, egregiousness of behavior, didn't see it. But did an unprofessional behavior occur? It did, in my opinion. I mean, it was a lapse in judgment in the moment. I totally see that. But when I look at extending boundaries and we talk about, you know, ensuring that everything that you do with that client is therapeutic in nature, I don't see anything therapeutic about asking your or agreeing to allow your client to go pick up an object for you. So I'd love to hear from my peers. Again, I don't see egregious nature of this, but I do find for the violation that there was a boundary concern that did occur. The client did go and pick up a personal object for the licensee. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts are on all that.
I had a question when you were talking about the issue of random conversation and talking about the building and stuff. Would that not have been covered had he been documented that in his notes, say, prior to the session or right after, we talked about blah, 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 and just that, you know, kind of has to do with building his self-esteem or whatever. I mean, could have been just included in there just a quick note that that had made it a better.
I mean, it seemed to me like those conversations had occurred kind of as they were wrapping up and in between, like bringing him from the front door to the office. So you wouldn't typically document any of that. It's really just about, you know, if in his note, if he says, you know, developing therapeutic rapport, it's really what you would usually see. Mm-hmm. And how you do that, right?
Okay.
Right. How you would do that is up to you. But any comments about.
I and notice of full disclosure, I'm a veteran. So I think sometimes working with veterans is a little bit different. So when I read this, I see one veteran helping another veteran. Then you also have that license that gets in the way. So you kind of, and I don't know how to explain it. God probably knows. When someone says they're a veteran, there's like this connection you have because you know what they've been through, they know what you've been through. And just it's just a little bit different. So maybe if they both weren't veterans, I'd be okay with the boundary, but I don't know, we just help each other sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I sat here, and yes, I'm perceiving the moment as a veteran myself, a Vietnam-era veteran, and I would hope, frankly, that if I had a therapist who was a veteran, that if I needed something like that, a battery, totally not personal, would that person, would that therapist allow himself or herself to slip into a case management position for just a moment and help me out? And as a veteran, I might do that for sure. I would try to be mindful because of the number of years that I've been here hearing disciplinary matters and frankly, issuing discipline on all sorts of things. So I might not do it. I might not slip into the case management role. But that's what I see here. I see that the therapist slipped into a case management role within a responsible context. So for me, I will respect the rules. But frankly, I would not issue any hard discipline for the battery purchase. It shouldn't have been done by the therapist. But it's certainly could have and should have been done by a case manager.
Are you guys saying that you're more looking towards more of a letter of concern, less of an NDCA? Is that what I'm hearing, or?
Well, the NCDA would be for education is already completed, so.
Correct. I mean, ultimately, it's like one's, you know, letter of concern is documentation, then it's NDCA, a little bit more. But it seems like, based off of what I'm hearing, you guys are kind of leaning towards that path, even though he did complete the education. Or are you talking about a total dismissal?
I'm talking about non-violation. So I think Dr. Chang was looking for a
violation. Okay, so you're NDCA or lower?
There's a boundary crossing and boundary violation, and I would put this in a boundary crossing due to the fact that, and to what Mary said, I think if he would have documented, you know, I allowed this client to go pick up the boundary because it built trust, and I felt like it strengthened our relationship, and that's why I crossed it. If it would have been documented, then I think we would have been okay. But I don't think it rises to a level of violation, even though it did happen. So,
agreed, I'm the same.
Yeah. I would agree.
The director has a comment.
How could you tell?
Yeah, we read minds, don't you know?
I just wanted to address the members. As I appreciate you, you know, speaking about veterans, and thank you for that. But with that said, as administratively reviewing this, that's not something that comes to our mind. To be clear, we put this as not apparent, not because it didn't occur, but because we wanted the board members to make the decision whether it rose to the level of discipline or not. If this was on its own, it likely would have been a letter of concern in NDCA, but it's not. It's actually with egregious documentation errors in regards to somebody that's in private practice. So I just kind of want to put that on the record. I think we're kind of right now we're only talking about the battery incident, which I think has been agreed upon that it shouldn't have occurred, but it did. But it doesn't rise to the level of discipline. Just wanted the board members to make that decision. But I just wanted to make sure that we didn't miss that documentation piece as we're discussing NDCAs.
And usually if it's just documentation, it would be
it was not egregious, but this is an individual that's been in private practice since 2004, and almost every element is missing in the informed consent, and the consent for treatment was signed over a year after they received the board complaint. I just think that's something that should be considered. Not to say you can't dismiss it with an NDCA, but usually documentation that results in an NDCA is egregious than that.
And I think to piggyback off of that, when somebody has been licensed for that long and we see egregious documentation concerns, where my mind goes is you haven't taken the onus to review the updated rules and statutes and what's required of you, and that's concerning to me that much time has clearly passed. Either you didn't do it or you didn't care to do it or you did it and disregarded it to that extent. So I agree that the battery and the conversations that happened, I don't believe any of that rises to a violation. I appreciate him owning it. I do think the documentation is. But I appreciate that he's also rectified it in the meantime. So.
Mm. And for me, when I hear about the documentation and the number of years in practice and that sort of thing, I remind myself that the reason that we developed and require the completion of the tutorial on rules and laws and so forth is so that we can reduce that problem for professionals if they run into trouble. If they have done what they were supposed to do, chances are they will not come and say, I didn't know that was. So I would not back off of recognizing the violation associated with in some way.
So, okay. I think I know where I want to go with this, but I want to go back to something that Mrs. Zemanski had mentioned, which I think was really important, was, again, distinguishing between, you know, crossing a professional boundary versus crossing a boundary violation. And I don't see that there was a boundary violation. And when you look at everything in here, you talk about welfare of the client and safety and causing harm, and I don't see any of that. It was a lapse of judgment in the moment. So I would say that I do not see clear and convincing evidence to support any violation of boundaries, but there is clear and convincing evidence of the documentation deficiencies. I am. So I move that we find the licensee in violation of documentation deficiencies, ARS 3232-5116P, for neither of you, for all the other.
As a reason.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like.
I don't mind. I need practice reading anyways. AAC R461101, consent for treatment. AAC R461102, treatment plan. AAC R461103, client record. AAC R461104, financial and bills records. And then AAC R461106, telepractice.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor. Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Next up.
Well, since the licensee has already completed a lot of the education that I would have asked for him to complete, I'm not really sure where else to go with this. You know, I think the licensee did mention at some point in time that he was registered for record keeping, in psychotherapy and counseling, ethical, legal, clinical issues that are 6 CEUs. I'd still like to see that completed. And don't know if there's any further education that we want to add to that, but I'd be okay with just that. That is my motion. So I move that we offer a consent agreement with a requirement to complete education in record keeping and psychotherapy and counseling.
Well, NDCA, though.
No, we found the violation.
We found the violation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bella, do you want
to? Well, I just want to be 6 CEUs in record keeping. Are you naming a class that he registered for?
I mean, because it does say here.
Like clinical documentation.
That's fine. I'm referencing an actual course that Legacy mentioned he was already. Yeah, so.
So we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. He'd be required to take 6 CEUs. Behavioral health documentation, if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
So moved.
For a second.
And again, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Gerald Zemanski. Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Mr. Carey, I believe you can sit tight.
Okay.
We will go to 7D. Norma Masonet, case present. All right. Introduce yourself to the record, please.
Chair Dobratz, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for licensee.
Norma Masonet, LPC.
Thank you both, and we will first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, there was a supplement uploaded to the member portal yesterday in regards to CEU that had been taken, just as a side note. And additionally, I wanted to share with the board members that initially when this board analysis or report was sent out to the board members, board staff was recommending ARS 3232516B, which is using fraud or deceit in connection with rendering services. After some communication amongst myself and staff and our board's legal advisor, based on the fact that this individual did not compensate financially, it appears that the violations would be more appropriate would be the Q violation, which is failure to keep records, as well as the L violation, which we're all familiar with in regards to impaired practice, not suggesting substance abuse impaired practice, but just adding the L violation because of the egregiousness of not maintaining the records. So moving forward, this recommendation is based on the following from 47 to 421, licensee provided behavioral health services at agency. An investigation of licensee's telehealth sessions from 1220 to 221 revealed overbilling issues. Based on these findings, agency terminated licensee's employment. Licensee represented the following regarding the overbilling. In 320, the pandemic disrupted in-person therapy sessions. This led to increasing difficulty spending hours in front of the computer. To remedy this, licensee began taking breaks between some of her client sessions. At times, licensee failed to record the end time of the sessions. As a result, there were instances where she would guess the end times of the sessions. Licensee now realizes it's both wrong and unethical. Licensee never thought to ask if there was a way, such as a log, to see when prior sessions ended.
Licensee made her best guess on when the session ended. At the time, licensee had so many things on her mind and documentation, accuracy was probably not at the top of her list. Licensee did not do this for material gain since she was a salaried employee. Purposely adding additional time to therapy sessions would not have benefited licensee in any way. Licensee's claims that adding additional time to therapy sessions would not have benefited her in any way are contradicted by licensee's personnel records at agency. Specifically, in 2 of 20, licensee received a formal disciplinary warning, which was documented as a final warning that included the following: concerns about productivity, concerns that licensee's productivity was still below the expectation of 60%. In an attempt to increase productivity, licensee asked her supervisor if she could bill for an assessment if the client was not present. Her supervisor said no, the client must be present for an assessment. Despite the licensee wrote assessments and the documents were determined to be fraudulent. Licensee completed 3 assessments despite having been scheduled to be off of work. A conflict visit report shows times licensee billed for one service while documenting other services. The following issues are being addressed in this corrective action plan: fraudulent billing practices, inaccurate reporting of time in and out of the office, and documentation lack of timeliness. This serves as a final warning for the above-mentioned issues. Further infractions will result in disciplinary action, including termination. Based on her 220 disciplinary warning, licensee clearly stood to benefit from adding additional hours, since overbilling directly and positively impacted her productivity numbers. Specifically, between 1220 and 221, licensee productivity numbers were inflated as follows based on the number of hours overbilled. In 1220, productivity increased from 54% to 61%. In 1 of 21, her productivity increased from 52 to 61%. In 221, her productivity increased from 57 to 66%. By increasing her productivity numbers above 60% by overbilling, licensee benefited by avoiding further potential disciplinary action, including possible termination. As outlined below, the sheer frequency and volume of the overbilling discrepancies in 1 year period between 420 and 321 is concerning. A total of 781 discrepancies. Differences between documented time and actual time ranged from 1 minute up to as much as 79 minutes. 95 of the discrepancies exceeded 20 minutes. In addition to the systematic overbilling, licensee continued to inappropriately sign behavioral health paperwork as a BHP as late as 120, despite allowing her license to expire in 10 of 19. Licensee's inappropriate preparation of clinical documentations with the BHP signature had the potential of invalidating all corresponding services she provided at agency. Licensee represented the following regarding the expiration of her license. Licensee got her dates mixed up and was rushing to get the paperwork into the board. Licensee immediately notified agency once she discovered her license and expired. According to the personnel records, agency made this discovery, not licensee. Licensee did not know that the agency may have had to go back and refund claims made during this time and understands why this is an issue. By inaccurately and inappropriately documenting clinical records, licensee fraudulently rendered services to behavioral health clients. It is also concerning that despite resigning in lieu of termination from agency for fraudulent documentation, licensee was not transparent when she included the following in the resume she submitted to her current employer: I resigned due to changes in the agency in the last year, disagreements about putting clients first, and I am seeking a higher salary than the agency can offer. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Are there any questions from board members? Mr. Carey, you and your client have up to 6 minutes to address the board.
All right. I'm going to have the licensee address the board first.
Members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I want to say that I am deeply sorry for my conduct. I understand that I am a representative of the profession, and I fail to proudly represent a profession that I am so blessed to be a part of. My sloppiness and inattentiveness were not acceptable. I have done a lot of self-reflection and have considered my actions. Around the time these errors took place, I was experiencing a personal life transition and major upheaval. And as I was going through this, COVID became an additional stressor. With little notice, I was sent home from work to start providing teletherapy without training or equipment. I had never even used Zoom before. It was a complete mental shift and unfamiliar setting for me. I'm sharing this with you not as an excuse, but for you to know that I have analyzed what went wrong so that it does not happen again. I appreciate that even when we are not at our professional best, we must meet the standard of care, including when it comes to billing, time management, and recording of session information. If I could do it over again, I would reach out for support instead of trying to deal with it all by myself. I think I misread the situation and interpreted my employer's decision to send us home as a signal that I was supposed to figure it out all by myself. I understand that that was not so, and I obviously didn't view the situation appropriately. With my new employer, I have sought the support of those around me. I have coworkers who are available to support and guide me when I have questions, and a supervisor who's working closely with me to make sure I remain compliant with all board and ethical requirements. I have also completed a total of 12 CEs on billing and documentation ethics, and I have completed the statutes and regulations course on the board's website. Both of these have refreshed my knowledge and reinforced for me the reasons for the rules we have as professionals. I hope you will accept my sincere apology. I have learned much from this experience, especially in regard to how I should conduct myself professionally in the future.
Chair Dobratz, members of the board, board staff's proposing an L and a Q in this case. As the board knows, I'm not a fan of L, but I think there are some instances where L does make sense, and I think that this licensee has identified some issues, some confounding issues that occurred, including COVID, personal transitions, that I think do inform this case. I would note a few things. First of all, she did not obtain any financial benefit. The investigator noted, quote, in subsequent communication with board staff, complainant verified with agency's accounting department that licensee did not receive a bonus during the time services were audited. I also thought that this was really a different type of investigative report and complainant response than I've seen in a lot of cases. The complainant stated, quote, she does not feel licensee overbilled in a malicious manner. I've seen cases where the prior employer is seeking to seriously impact someone's license. This is one in which the complainant said licensee is, quote, not a bad person. She is wonderful and a very talented clinician. I think the licensee was very direct in her response and the factors that contributed to her poor decision-making. I also think that the agency, to its credit, noted some training gaps and some educational gaps that occurred when it essentially, with no notice, told everyone to go home. I think this is one of those cases where a lot of things came together in the perfect storm, and it gave the licensee and a situation in which she made some bad choices. I think, though, that even the complainant is on board with the fact that this is someone who is a talented clinician and deserves some support. If you actually look through the records, there are indications of the licensee actually specifically addressing her supervisor and her employer about the need for additional support. Candidly, I'm digging out from a lot of these COVID cases where clinicians in front of your board, psych board, nursing board, the isolation and the change, it was just a paradigm we had not had before. Standard of care still needs to be met. That's not the purpose of my comments, but I think it is in context, and so I do ask that it be considered. With the L or the Q standing alone, depending on how the board has addressed these cases in the past, it has looked at doing typically a 12-month probation option for early term and staying out of trouble. I think she has done some things already that have shown, she is rehabilitatable. She has done courses, and she has good infrastructure at her new employer who is aware of the requirements that she will have. So I'd ask you to consider something along the lines of consistent with what you've done with previous Q cases. Obviously, you'll make the decision whether there's sufficient information for the L or the L and the Q together. I know you've gone different ways with Q by itself and Q and L together.
there any questions from board members?
I'm just curious how your were you in charge of scheduling your own client hours, like your appointments?
Yes.
Okay. And so when you're talking about then you threw in breaks, did you were you aware of scheduling those, or did it feel like you just had 8 hours booked back to back?
I was expected to schedule it back to back.
Okay. And so the breaks were your way of trading some time away from your computer screen. Okay. And then can I just ask what your efforts are to mitigate that in your new employment?
My new employment encourages breaks
okay.
in between and makes sure that we are taking care of ourselves in the practice of doing therapy.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
I had a question about the assessment, billing for assessment. You had asked about your supervisor about billing for assessment. If I did my math right, you'd been licensed for about 2 years.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how that comes up after 2 years of being licensed. Not now, did someone tell you before you could bill for assessment about it?
I obviously did not understand what I was being told. I was billing, I was speaking with a client, but I was not typing them and billing them as during that session. I was billing for the time that I was writing it. But I had spoken with the client and I had...
You actually had assessed the client? You weren't just...
No. I had...
Perfect.
Yeah.
And then, you probably can't answer this question, and... So I was confused about what the agency is calling all the billing and their tables. In this case, in the other case. So the way I read it is they added up all the Zoom time that subtracted from all the times you documented, and then they came up with a number of hours and just for ease, they'll say 10 hours. And then they said that you overbilled and they multiplied 10 hours, and for ease, say $140 an hour. They came up with $1,400, which is not the numbers in here. But I don't, do you know if they were actually, because it looks like they took the minutes and computed them into hours and then computed them back into units. Do you know if, because some we can, right, we have like an 8-minute rule. So not all of those times that you overbill or a different number resulted in overbilling. Do you know if they calculated that at all? Did they take that?
They did not tell me any specifics.
Okay, yeah, no one can answer the question. All right, so.
Yeah, and I think you've hit on an issue, which is that, you know, normally, if in a case like this, if this were to progress to a hearing or anything, we'd subpoena and get their behind-the-scenes math, and we'd get to actually ask people some of those really heavily technical questions. But, yeah, a lot of the billing was 1 minute off. I mean, there was a significant amount that was only a minute off, and there is a savings clause in a lot of the insurance billing that prevents, especially depending on the units you're using for a particular service. So I think distilling it down, it's not as broad as it was, and I think that you can look at how the complainant responded, that it's, I don't think they're treating this as a, at that level, that it is significant. It is a little bit smaller universe, and I think it's more accurately reflected in how the complainant engaged with the investigator about how they feel about it and how they perceive it.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I have all that information. If you go from 52 to 53 minutes, it's only 1 minute, but it changes the unit. But if you go from 53 to 60, at 7 minutes, it doesn't change anything as far as the information. So we don't have any of that information, but even without that information, I think there's still enough in there to say some of the billing probably didn't happen. What the amount is, I don't think is correct, what was reported to us from the agency. If the way I interpret the way they did, they went from I'm sorry I got into the weeds in that. I was just on the other case. It just
true.
Thank you for giving us what the inside is too. What's going on in there?
And not to go too much further in the weeds, but CMS and the AMA, who set forth a lot of the standards of billing, their position is that if there is either an upcode, so for instance, you bill based too much complexity when you didn't give enough complexity, or if you upcode it based on time, CMS treats that as an error. It doesn't actually treat it as fraud. Fraud is when no services were provided, but billing still occurred. And so I think it also fits nicely into the context here of that even CMS and AMA would not necessarily treat this as a fraud situation. They treat this as a misbill situation. And the only reason I know that is because I'm dealing with CPT codes in other situations. But that's also why I thought this was deviating from the B makes some sense here.
Questions?
I think I have one more. I'm sorry. There's an element in the investigation that's worth noting, meaning the productivity numbers themselves did, in light of all of that, somehow we just barely got over that 60%, which was needed. Did you talk with that with your supervisor, or I'm just saying when we see it, you know, we're just barely under, which would result in disciplinary action. And then somehow we just finally, you know, 3 months in a row, we get just barely over. It just catches my eye more than once that I was just wondering if that was a conversation you and your supervisor had about change of productivity.
In terms of increasing my productivity?
Well, just noting maybe that it was increased and so you were, you know, good. You were kind of, you know, minimally meeting what they're expecting.
There was one instance during supervision that she said, good job. I will be honest. It is important, obviously, but it was not on the top of my list, to be honest with you. It really wasn't.
Anything else? It's our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not. Quinlan was going to lead this discussion. It's similar to you. I know the next one that you were going to lead, Mr. Szymanski, so I don't know if you want to start us off on thoughts.
Sure, I'll start you off. So I'm in agreement with not finding the B or the reasons given, and it doesn't, maybe she wasn't disciplined, but there was no financial gain. But there was an extensive number that didn't match, that were more than just a couple minutes. And although some of that when it changed the billing because of that, it does change because minutes do count towards production. So it does affect production number percentage. It doesn't necessarily, although it probably did affect billing. So, and then it we have 12Q and 12L. Right? And I'm not a
16Q.
Oh, so did
12 was like
a long time ago. Sorry.
Five rules ago.
All right. And you know, like Mr. Flynn, I'm not a fan of L, but I think with the just the sheer number, and we're not going with fraud, that maybe L would apply with Q, even though we don't always do that, because we're not finding B. But I don't know what.
Madam Chair, could I add something, not so much to that, but more so for our public members? Because I think that every once in a while you all are talking about something where I think there's a piece that's important that might be missing. And I think one part that's missing is that when an individual's license expires, they no longer have a license, right? And they have a 90-day period where they can, what you call, reinstate their license, but they're not licensed during that time. So they can't be legally practicing under their license, whether in private practice or in an agency. This particular agency was DHS licensed, so legally she was able to, but with that said, she was still basically putting it as if she was licensed and didn't notify the agency. I don't want to lose that in this because it definitely is an overbilling. I think 95 discrepancies were over 20 minutes because I understand what Mr. Szymanski is saying. But I just don't want to lose that piece. I think it's important for the members to know that, you know, she technically was using a license that she didn't have for a couple of months. It just added to it, but you all didn't talk about it, so I just wanted to make sure that was a piece of it.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That part. And again, we don't know what the chief and age codes or CPC codes or things like that. So I wish the case presented it, because I think that 30 But again, getting into the weeds. back to Q and Q and L.
Black to everyone else's thoughts. I'm in agreement. That's in Q and L on this.
All right. So I'll make a motion to find for 16, Q and L.
Is there a second?
Potter, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Some of the suggestions I had, and I think that 16 hours of a telecourse would be helpful, and I think it should be either live, in person, or web, or at the very minimum a video. A lot of agencies or organizations now are offering like a two-day certification. So you could, but I think it's more than just trying to read and do it online by yourself through the CEUs. So you have questions about assessment after 2 years. Maybe that having a live person or a semi-live person, a taped person, a video, would be helpful. I also think that staying out of trouble would be helpful. I think that's always helpful. I'm not sure if we feel like a graduate course in ethics would be necessary. So that
she did take a 6-hour ethical decision making and a 6-hour record keeping that also covered ethical, legal, and clinical issues. So those.
Okay. All right. So I guess if everyone's okay with staying out of trouble and 16 hours of a basically 2 days. I don't know. Should we say 14? I don't know if they're all. I'm thinking 2 days. Training them.
I believe.
Okay, so let's do 12. And if you do 13, great. 15, even better. We'll do 12. What I want is 2 days of either attending or attending a live webcast or minimum budget. So that would be my motion. I don't know.
Unless there's any other feedback on that. So would be offering her consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent. 12 CEUs in telehealth must be either live or video. If not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
Yes.
Is there a second?
Can I give a second? Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Best of luck to you. Next, we're going to go to 7B, Mr. Elder. Yes. Are you Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe we're getting your attorney on the phone.
Correct.
Good afternoon. This is Brenton speaking.
Hi, Mr. Barber. This is Patricia, the board's chairperson.
Hi. How are you doing?
I am doing well, thank you. We are getting ready to hear Mr. Elder's matter. He has come forward, and we're first going to hear a brief summary from board staff.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the board, so in looking at the analysis, this is very similar. Originally, board staff was recommending a B violation using fraud or deceit in rendering services. Based on further review, we are, instead of a B, recommending an L and a Q violation. And this recommendation is based on the following. From 417 to 421, licensee provided behavioral health services at agency. An investigation of licensee's telehealth sessions from 1220 to 221 revealed overbilling issues. Based on these findings, licensee resigned in lieu of termination. Licensee represented the following regarding the overbilling. During the pandemic, it was an incredible challenge to switch from seeing clients in person to seeing them over Zoom. Licensee documented the time that he logged into Zoom as the start time of the session. Licensee felt he was concentrating while waiting for the client. He never thought he was not providing a service if they signed into the meeting or were admitted to the meeting late. Quote, I wouldn't necessarily put what time they showed up, end quote. There could be up to 15 minutes of time at the start of the session that licensee was not seeking a client that he billed for. Licensee did not make a note of when a client would log in. Licensee did not make a note of when the session ended. Licensee would estimate the time. Licensee does not have a good answer for why he chose to guess when session started and ended rather than checking the clock for the exact time. This was never done for monetary gain, as licensee was a salaried employee. Licensee denied having any difficulty keeping up with productivity requirements during the time he was providing telehealth services. Licensee's denial that he had difficulty keeping up with productivity requirements during the time he was telecommuting seeks to insinuate he would not have benefited from overbilling. However, this is clearly contradicted by licensee's personnel records and agency's productivity policy. Specifically, in 9 of 19, licensee received a formal disciplinary warning that indicated licensee consistently fell below agency's requirement of 60% productivity. Based on licensee's own admissions, if an employee was below productivity requirements, they would be in trouble. Between 1220 and 221, licensed productivity numbers were inflated as follows based on the number of hours overbilled. In 1220, from 45% to 59%, in 121, from 43% to 57%, and in 221, from 47% to 61%. By substantially increasing his productivity numbers by overbilling, licensee benefited by avoiding further potential disciplinary action, including termination, as occurred to licensee with his employer prior to agency. As outlined below, the sheer frequency and volume of the overbilling discrepancies in a one-year period between 420 and 321 is concerning. A total of 805 discrepancies with 57 different clients, 195 instances of overbilling of between 11 and 20 minutes, 237 instances of overbilling of more than 20 minutes, and 4 instances of overbilling between 50 and 80 minutes. By inaccurately and inappropriately documenting clinical records, licensee fraudulently rendered services to behavioral health clients. It is also concerning that, despite the lieu of termination from agency from fraudulent documentation, licensee was not transparent when he included the following when submitting his employment application to his current employer, reason for leaving, seeking higher salary. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Are there any questions from board members? Mr. Barber, you and your client together have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
Yes, briefly. I just want to, I know you've all read the investigation. I just do want to emphasize that the licensee showed up at work one day and at 10 o'clock was told that he had to leave and could not come back except to get a laptop to continue doing his work. He was doing his work from a walk-in closet in his home, and it was a tremendously stressful period of time. I was going to spend this time explaining why this did not constitute fraud as originally alleged, but as the executive director noted, that has been amended, and licensee does not deny those acts of unprofessional conduct. However, he absolutely maintains that this was not fraud, this was not done for gain, and that's partly evidenced by the fact that the inflated numbers didn't reach the 60% mark. With that, I will leave my remaining time for any questions you might have for the licensee, and I thank you so much.
Thank you. Carol, anything to add before questions?
Just that I really, really feel sorry and have learned from this, and I'm working with my supervisor to continue to take, and we'll take all recommended courses to try to be better at documentation and, if needed, providing telehealth and providing in-person services.
Questions from board members?
I have a question. Is there... You said that you had connection issues with Zoom, and I think a lot of us did. And you switched to a telephone. Why not just document that in your notes?
I really wish that I had done better time with documentation. I wasn't good at putting the start time or the end time or when I switched. Means of communication with the client.
And I can understand first going to Zoom, you get on at 10 o'clock and somebody logs in at 2 to 3 o'clock without any training white people. But switching to a phone, then it throws up, call the client. But and as far as the end times, the guessing, a lot of your notes are after the incident. I don't think I would remember the summer.
I feel like between pandemic fatigue and taking care of my kids with COVID, I am absolutely doing the best. Also, at my new job to 4 hours.
I think in your did you talk about collaborative documentation? Somebody frowning on that? No.
All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
So again, just like reach out and ask a couple questions about this case. But I think there's enough there to justify the Q and the L. I'm not sure there's enough violations. Are kind of there's different cases. There was enough of it that I think there was a level of violation. Although I understand the circumstances and how that happened. So, if you're able to check the Q and L. I'll make a motion for 16 Q and L.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Suggestions for?
Again, I was thinking the 6 hours of staying out of trouble or light course and 16 hours again of telehealth. 12 hours of telehealth training, either live, in person on the web, or video training. Something, a 2-day training that gives what we should be doing. Hopefully we don't have it. This doesn't happen again, but we don't know what's going to happen. And if we're still providing any telehealth at all, we should. And I don't know. I don't think the last case graduate level course is necessary. My motion would be for those people.
Paula, do you want to read back what you captured?
Just for the record, we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. They would be required to take 6 contact hours and staying out of trouble or the equivalent. 12 contact hours in telehealth, either video or live, preferably live, and if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Your motion, Mr. Smith?
That'd be my motion. Thank you.
For a second?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey?
Aye.
Mary Coonrod?
Aye.
Cedric Davis?
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz?
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan?
Aye.
Mark Shin?
Aye.
Gerald Zemanski?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
I do want to note, because I didn't say this on the last case, but I appreciate board staff and the investigative team working to address the violations. That made sense given the circumstances, so I appreciate that. Mr. Barber, I appreciate you being available, and thank you, Mr. Elder. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I am feeling the need for a break, if that is okay. We can take a break. Let's take 10 minutes. It's 12:33. And we will go back on the record at 12:33. We're going to go to agenda item number 7A. Ms. Axford, is the complainant here? You can come forward. I believe we're going to get the licensee on the phone.
This is Darcy.
Hey, Darcy. This is Patricia, the board's chairperson.
Hello.
Hey, we are getting ready to hear your matter. And the way that we'll proceed, we have reviewed all of the materials in the case. We will first hear a brief summary from board staff, and then the complainant who's present will have a chance to address us, and then you'll have a chance to address us. So I would ask that you mute your phone until we're ready to hear from you, please.
Okay.
Thank you. And a brief summary from board staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-K-16-K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following section of the ACA Code of Ethics. A6B, multiple clients. This recommendation is based on the following. Stepmother had been licensee's client for approximately 3 years when she asked licensee to see client and father for communication issues. From beginning services with client and father, licensee represents she provided individual counseling to father and family counseling to client and father. Although licensee maintained separate clinical records for the individual and family services, the consents for treatment did not indicate whether the services were individual or family. Accordingly, the lack of specificity in the clinical documentation did not clarify the nature of the relationship licensee had with each family member. Licensee represented the following to board staff. For years, licensee has heard about the crap that has come from complainant. Licensee heard a lot about complainant and father's conflicts with their children and parental interference issues. And, quote, in my opinion, from everything I've heard, is extremely manipulative. Licensee acknowledged that she probably had bias against complainant. Despite having provided services to stepmother for years, being keenly aware of the intense family dynamics, as well as being aware of her own admitted bias towards complainant, licensee chose to initiate behavioral health services with client and father. It is concerning that licensee indicated to board staff that she does not think her bias, the bias she may have had against licensee, had any influence on the services she provided, despite sending the following email. Quote, and it is clearly making her crazy that I haven't responded. I will not be responding. She knows damn good and well that I can't respond without a consent form signed. She is so manipulative. Ugh. If she continues to email me, I may block her email address. It should be noted that licensee intended to send this email to father, but inadvertently sent it to complainant. Despite being independently licensed for nearly two decades, it is concerning and demonstrates a lack of insight that licensee agreed to perform potentially conflicting roles by providing behavioral health services to client and father. Additionally, following the review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16-K, failing to make client records in the licensee's possession promptly available to the client, a minor client's parent, or the client's legal guardian. This recommendation is based on the following. From January 8, 2021 to February 5, 2021, licensee provided two family behavioral health sessions to father and client. Client was a minor at the time of these sessions, and complainant was a joint legal guardian with father. In February 2021, complainant sent licensee an email requesting client's records. Despite ARS 12-2293 requiring a licensee to release records to a patient or the patient's healthcare decision maker upon their written request, licensee failed to provide complainant with client's records. Licensee represented the following to board staff. Licensee did not provide the records to complainant because she did not have a signed consent from father to release client's records. Father's records were part of the clinical record, and it did not seem right to licensee for complainant to be able to see that. While ARS 12-2293 authorizes a healthcare provider to deny a request for records that is reasonably likely to cause substantial harm to a client, there was not a reasonable basis in this case for licensee to deny complainant's records. Complainant's request. It's concerning that licensee, who has been independently licensed and in private practice for nearly two decades, appears not to understand the basic release of records requirements. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to the consent for treatment plan, and clinical and client record. This recommendation is based on the following. Licensee's consents for treatment for father and client were missing the following required element: notification of the licensee's supervision or involvement with a treatment team of professionals. Licensee's treatment plan was missing the following required elements: father's signature and the date when the treatment plan would be reviewed. Licensee's progress notes were missing the following element: licensee's dated signature. Licensee represented the following to board staff. All of the treatment forms were created in 2004 when she was going into private practice. There were small updates over the years. Licensee will update her treatment forms to ensure they meet minimum board requirements. After the board complaint, licensee ultimately provided board staff with documents, including the consent for treatment, treatment plan, and progress notes that appear to meet the board's minimum requirements. And that's all board staff has, unless you have any questions for us.
Board members have any questions? Ms. Rogers, you have up to 6 minutes to address the board.
Okay. Thank you for your time. I'm here because I do have a lot of concern with having a minor child that was seen by somebody that did not understand the full picture. We have a very toxic and complicated divorce, and so we do have court agreements written and in place to ensure that the children's needs and concerns that they have are put in place. So we have a court-approved therapist that the children have been seeing for the past 5 years. And this court-approved therapist also does family sessions with myself and my children privately, and then has and does do private sessions with my ex-husband and the children privately as well. We are required by our court documents to have access to the dates that they attend therapy, but that doesn't mean I have access to what is being said. And I don't want access. I just want to make sure that my children's mental well-being is properly being managed. I actually do have a transgender child, my oldest. She is now a he and has been trying for 2 years to properly and in a healthy way come out to his father. And the therapy that took place with Darcy actually really set back the relationship between my ex-husband and transgender child. Quite a bit. I was accused of being a narcissist within the first session by Ms. Axford and my ex-husband, and my child felt very trapped and very, very unsafe during that therapy session, and it has, like I said, resulted in a very negative outcome with my ex-husband and my transgender child that I have been trying to get to a safe place so that he can properly come out to his father. And I think therapy is a great thing. The therapist that my children have been seeing for the last 5 years has created a very strong and safe environment for my children. They're learning boundaries that I'm so excited for them to have with from parents to friends to each other. It's really great to see that slow improvement. So any derailment has just been hard on me. It's been hard on my child, and I understand that maybe I might seem not like the greatest person, but to my ex-husband. But that's why we're divorced. I mean, you know, and it's unfortunate. I don't see great things about him. He doesn't see great things about me. But we shouldn't be discussing that with our children. And that was one of the other concerns I had with Ms. Axford, is she specifically told my husband and child that he should be involved in our parent drama. And I don't agree with that. I don't. It is hurt my kids so badly when their father puts them in the middle of our drama. And for a professional to say that my children should be put in drama that is a result of their parents, you're not taking care of my child's mental well-being. That really concerns me, being a therapist, when you're dealing with minors. You know, and then we're mixing in the teen years, which is already complicated, and then we're mixing in transgender roles. Like, that's, we're looking at a recipe for disaster here, and all I wanted was for Ms. Axford and Ms. Bear to connect together and make sure they were on the same page, and instead I was being threatened to be blocked and out to be like a crazy person. And all I wanted was just for those two to make sure they were on the same page, so any progress my child had made wasn't derailed any further than it had already been. So children have fragile minds. I'm here.
Board members have any questions?
Just one question, ma'am. When you see the impact of unhealthy relationship activities between yourself and your ex or whatever, what would it take to stop it?
I don't have negative interactions with my ex in front of my children. This is behind closed doors. So any involvement that the children would learn about the apparent drama would come from my ex-husband telling them what was said and what was done. And that's not in our court agreement to discuss that. And it shouldn't be discussed with the children. They don't need to know whenever we're in a disagreement about something and we're fighting. We don't do it in front of the children. But they don't need to be dressed. He sits them down and keeps them up till 11 o'clock at night telling them what we're fighting about, and that's not okay. And someone telling my ex-husband and encouraging him to do that and telling my child that he should listen to that is very concerning, because it's a very complicated, very complicated.
Thank you.
Any other questions from board members? Ms. Axford?
Yes, I'm here.
You would now have up to 6 minutes to address the board if you wish to do so.
Okay, well, the first thing I'm going to address is at no time did I make a blanket statement that children should be involved in all of their parents' drama. That would be a ridiculous thing for me to say. There was one specific issue that was discussed, and that was that Angela, Lissy's mother, took her daughter to get the driver's permit and check the form that she was the sole custodial parent, and did not include Oliver in that activity, which was very hurtful to him, and he missed an opportunity to participate in that with his daughter, and both father and daughter expressed upset about that. And I said, yes, I believe Oliver should be honest with Lissy about what happened with that one particular incident. Number two, when I received the email from Angela demanding records, I was quite taken aback. I will admit I was singularly focused on protecting Oliver's confidentiality. and didn't think outside of that. And I should have, but I don't work with adolescents and family sessions. I don't do family therapy on a regular basis. I did do it as a favor to Becky, Oliver's wife, because Oliver said that he had asked Catherine, the children's therapist, had asked her twice for a family session with himself and his daughter, and was twice denied by Catherine. That's when they came to me and asked me if I would try to help them. Nothing was discussed about Lissy's transgender transition. I didn't even know she was doing that. It was not brought up in the session. The sole purpose of me seeing the father and daughter was to help them facilitate communication, healthy communication, and build trust in Oliver's home when Lissy is there on his parenting time. That was the entire purpose of the counseling. It had nothing to do with Lissy's mother. At no time did Oliver and I tell Lissy her mother is a narcissist. That is not true, period. And in Angela's complaint, she wrote that the children's therapist, Catherine, had reached out to me several times, and I didn't respond. I never heard from Catherine, ever. Not a phone call, a voicemail, a text, an email, nothing. So that's just it's just a lie, period. That's just a lie. I really don't have anything else to say.
Okay. Let me see if board members have any questions for you.
I do, Ms. Axford. I'm Kim Bailey here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll start with just your most recent comment just now, which when you said it had nothing to do with the client's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not think that treating a minor child, the treatment itself, is of concern of both parents?
Well, in this case, given that it was specifically about communication between father and daughter, I don't know how that, when at father's home on his parenting time, I don't know how that concerns mother.
So the idea that the child is in treatment itself, no content, just that they're seeing a therapist, is not any
Oliver,
mother's concern in your mind?
No, I'm not saying that. She has a right to know that. Oliver did disclose to the children's therapist, Catherine, that he was taking his daughter to a different therapist to work on issues specific to them in his home. Catherine was made aware. It appears he did not make Angela aware.
Okay. And let me back up a little bit. Can you talk to me about your process in general just for seeing children?
I don't see children as a rule. I don't see any children under the age of 14. And seeing kids 14 and above is less than 0.5% of what I do in my practice.
Okay. What's your process for seeing adolescents 14 and above?
I'm not sure what you're asking by the process, but the parents obviously always have to be there to sign all the consents and all that stuff, and I'll start a session with the parent and the child to make sure we are all on the same page. And then if the child wants the parent to stay, the parent stays throughout the session, and if they don't, the parent goes out into the waiting area while I complete the session with the patient. And then in subsequent sessions, it's generally just the patient, unless it's a family therapy situation. But again, it is incredibly rare that I even do that.
Okay. And what is your training or knowledge of just how to handle court-appointed providers?
Well, my training was that if there's a court-appointed provider, then everything goes through them. I asked Oliver a couple of weeks ago after my investigative interview, because Jacqueline had brought up that Catherine was court-appointed, and at no point in time have I ever heard that. And so I reached out and asked him simply if she was court-appointed. He was extremely adamant she was not. He said that she was found by Angela in 2016. The kids started going to her. They continued with her, and then in 2019, I believe, when the parenting agreement was updated through the court, that both Oliver and Angela agreed that the children would continue with Catherine. And so the verbiage I've seen in a couple of things now says court-approved therapist versus court-appointed therapist. And I believe there's a distinction between those two, but perhaps I am wrong on that.
In the investigation, it appears that you were uncomfortable knowing how to ask for court papers, how to ask for that information. Is that true?
I'm not sure what you're asking. Uncomfortable asking for court papers?
Right.
I think I know what you're saying. I asked Jacqueline. I said, so, again, seeing kids is less than 0.5%, honest to God, of what I do in my practice. So when this whole thing happened, one of my questions was, I said, so when therapists are doing intakes, right, first visit with a child and their parent brings them, do they ask people to bring their parenting plan or the court papers with them? Is that something that's normally done? Because I wouldn't know. I'm not a marriage and family therapist. I've never advertised myself to be. I've never said I was. So maybe that's something that they know to do on the regular. It's not something that even crossed my mind.
Is that likely indicative, then, that we probably shouldn't have taken this case?
Yep. I wish I never had taken this case, to be honest.
Okay. I just had a couple, just real quick follow-up here. The notes that you provided, and I know you were uncomfortable providing them thinking they were for content, but you actually bill the father and the daughter on the same day, and I'm just wondering, were those two separate services?
They were two separate services. They were booked 2 hours each date of service.
Okay. And so it's unclear about that when you have notes that don't have the time on when the session starts. And I'm just throwing that out for whatever you want to do with that. When you just put an hour, it kind of looks like they're both in the same session. That's why I asked for the individual session, just to note that you had a different session documented and noted.
Well, I did, and I didn't include it when I originally sent the paperwork because it was just Oliver's notes, and I didn't think it was relevant. It had, you know, it didn't include Lissy. Mm-hmm. So there was a individual sessions with just Oliver and then a joint session with Oliver and Lissy.
Right. And then you note on the treatment plan that it's couples, individual, family work. You just kind of check all those. That was really confusing to see multiple modalities.
Well, I generally just check one box for whatever it is. You talking on the treatment plan or the progress note?
Treatment plan.
I don't have it in front of me, but I will check.
Okay.
I will check.
So I have that on the treatment plan, and then when I look at your billing record, you show that you billed the daughter under her own name, which would indicate she's your patient, not that she's just part of Dad's treatment. You bill her at 90791, which is an assessment.
First visit.
Right, and I'm just kind of throwing out that when I read the progress note on that, it's hard to delineate that it's an assessment that would lead to that diagnosis that you gave her. And then secondly, the second session you bill a 90837, which is an individual session for the daughter, but your note is a combined family session.
So I'm just trying
well,
to, it's really confusing because you have
I didn't bill a 90847 code, which is a family session. That's correct. I should have. And I just cost myself money there. But it was not an individual session with the daughter. It was joint between father and daughter.
Okay. And so it appears that you billed those. Okay. Fair enough.
Ms. Axford, this is Patricia. I have a couple questions as well.
Okay.
Did you inform Dad that you hadn't worked with adolescents, it wasn't your practice to do family therapy? Was he aware of, you know, your scope up until this point?
Yes, I believe he was aware. It's not that I have never worked with adolescents. It's just not, it's not a main area of focus for me. So I certainly have worked with adolescents in the past and with parents and adolescents. But it's, like I said, it literally is 0.5% of what I do. So it's not like I went into this having never worked with an adolescent, if that's what you're asking.
No, I wouldn't consider that informed Dad of your scope of practice and that it wasn't, you know, your area of specialty.
Well, I probably did say that to Becky when she asked me for the favor to do this. I may not have said it to Oliver, but, yeah, I think I didn't say it to him. To answer your question directly, no, I do not recall, actually. I don't recall saying that to him.
And that actually leads me to my second question. That's the second time that you've mentioned that this was a favor to an existing client, which, you know,
well,
let me finish my question, please. So to be flexible with your normal scope of practice and do a client a favor, did you not feel that you already had a bias and a lens going into working with two more members of this family?
I didn't, because what she presented to me was that he had asked Catherine twice to do a joint session with them, and she had refused. And she said they're really having trouble communicating. Lucy doesn't open up in the home. Oliver just wants her to feel safe and build trust. Do you think you can help them with communication? And I said, I can certainly try.
Why not provide resources to the family?
You mean outside of myself?
Correct.
Well, in retrospect, I certainly should have. It didn't occur to me at the time that this was going to turn into a problem.
And it's not about it turning into a problem. It's about the insight entering into a relationship when you've had established a relationship with one part of the family for an extended period of time, and this isn't your normal go. So it's about being proactive, not what ended up happening, but having that insight initially when you set up the client relationship.
Then I would say I did not have that insight in the moment. I certainly have it now.
Anybody else have any questions?
I just have a follow-up question. Kim Bailey again here. Can you tell me how many cases you currently have on your caseload that are open, that are under 18?
Zero.
And do you treat couples?
I do.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else have any questions?
Just a clarifying question. Hi, this is Jerry Smith. Just that last question I wanted to follow up on, Dr. Bailey. When you treat couples, are you doing it as couples counseling, or do you have an identified patient that's just one?
No, couples counseling.
Okay, thanks. I just want to clarify.
This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Dr. Bailey, I believe you're
here. I am. I think in light of the investigation material, the facts, I think very clearly support the violations that have been proposed in the investigation outcome. We have a past relationship that's been well established, and then we treat other parties, and even the
testament today that there's a lot of communication with the stepmother. You know, we know that we're working with blended families, high conflict families. You know, this is just something, we just don't cross those lines. You know, there's too many family, different families involved that need their own provider. And if the providers can collaborate, you know, appropriately so, that would be great. But that takes open communication and transparency in what we're all doing. And that just was completely lacking in this case. I think even some of the sentences or, you know, the verbiage given by the licensee in her investigation, you know, goes to say that there was no reason to take this case. There were biases, and that is a clear conflict of interest, let alone the, you know, the violation of having multiple clients that are inappropriate for the case. Not always inappropriate, but in this case it is, I think, clearly inappropriate. I do think we have some, obviously there were some documentation issues, and then withholding minors' records, it feels like the licensee does not necessarily know how to handle minors' records. And in just kind of in light of the progress, it just feels like there's not a working knowledge of how to actually work this case, how to actually give treatment to a minor. Content-wise, I'm not going on record saying she doesn't know what to do with a minor. I don't know that. But the documentation behind it would suggest the lack of that. That comes, you know, that comes with a study of family therapy and working with children is all also the administrative piece of that. So that appears to be lacking completely. I would say for the violations, I would also propose to you all that you consider, I'm going to consider M. I think she's completely out of scope. And I felt that way reading the case. I felt that way with her own testimony. And then I felt that way today. I think the responses today keep alluding that I don't normally do this. I'm a little bit concerned with the comment that they're less than 0.5% of my caseload, but then we also have a conflicting, or maybe we have another statement that says, of course, I've worked with children in the past. So now I'm worried. Has this been going on for 20, you know, almost two decades that we don't ask, is there a divorce? We don't ask, you know, what is the parenting plan? Let me see the documentation. Otherwise, I am to assume there's another biological parent involved in which I need to go, you know, in which I need to contact and get consent form or consent from. In light of even a statement, would an LMFT do this? Well, call one and ask. But we didn't do that either. So then I'm worried that we don't even have the insight that I'm working out of scope. I'm just going to, and to use her words, do someone a favor. And we don't do that we're working with minors and we have this kind of a case involved. We have a blended, you know, we have divorced parents. There's just too much at stake to get it, make it messy, let alone the content of whatever a child's coming in with. So I would like to add the M violation, which I normally don't add violations, but I think in this case it's appropriate.
Took the words right out of my mouth. I was finding it on the page as you said that, because not only a minor, but a family involved in obviously a high conflict custody situation, and so there were a number of red flags and no consultation with any other professional. I agree with that.
I would agree too. There was no seeking, and I don't get the sense that there's any desire to. Based on her testimony, I missed out on the money on that one. Well, it's not about that. This is to, you know, we don't do this profession to get rich. So, and then just knowing the conflict and the toxicity of the family dynamics, even in this email, there's a bias. And if you're not seasoned in the scope, how many other biases have you seen in other cases?
Okay. I move that we find for the violations of ARS 3232-5116K, multiple clients, as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics A6B, multiple clients, as well as ARS 3232-5116KK, withholding of minors' records, ARS 3232-5116P, documentation deficiencies, as well as 3232-5116M,
engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Suggestions for next step?
I do. So my thoughts were to suggest a graduate class in family therapy, and the reason for that is not so much to address, I'm hearing that there aren't any other family or child cases on her caseload, but in light of her saying she has had them in the past, there's nothing to prevent her from having them in the future. And if we are, I think we need the training, we need the coursework in that. And that could also help her decide whether she wants to do it or not, and at least be aware of that.
Especially working with couples too, mm-hmm. family and present, parenting concerns.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Ratz. Absolutely. I would add six units, continuing units, and just treating children, just to realize the importance of that. Again, if she decides to treat children from there, that's up to her. Maybe not after hearing what it all entails. It's tough work. I would attest to that. Six CEUs of seeing out of trouble or the equivalent. I would recommend six CEUs and boundaries and conflicts of interest. I would also say that during her consent agreement or probation time, that there's a stipulation put in that we don't take any children, families, or couples at this time, just in case that is the issue. If we have couples on her caseload now, I know I asked if she has couples therapy. I would suggest supervision 2 times a month or for 2 hours a month. I don't care when that is. Just to address those cases and make sure that she's getting some supervision while she's doing the continuing education, making sure those are not issues. So, Mr. Gratz, just to kind of, you know, there might be those kinds of issues with couples coming in. They might not be bringing in their children, but they're talking about it, and it would be incredibly important to be aware of all of this on the back end.
Supervision would be only if she's seeing couples, or are you suggesting supervision?
No, really, just if she's seeing, if she had any, I'd originally identify that in case she had any currently. Abruptly stopping treatment with families is really, it could be traumatizing, and I'm just aware of that. So my thought was if she had supervision around that for those cases, that could be appropriate. I'm open, though, to conversation on that.
Do you think that the violations that we have found would justify a practice audit?
For the documentation? Sure.
She resubmitted forms, right, that do meet the requirements now?
I didn't think about that. I mean, whatever, if everybody else has comments on that, I didn't think it would be necessary.
Maybe if she's working with a lot of kids. Recommendation to limit no kids during this time period. And I also agree with you just from the other thing. She already has current couples. That may get the supervision, but maybe also limit not to accept new couples until.
That would be consistent with my thoughts. So that's great. Thank you.
It was twice a month?
I just said 2 hours. I think that would be, the reason I said the time would be to adequately go through the case. I know sometimes we say 2 times a month, but it's really to staff those particular cases and work through them.
And that would be for 12 months?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. We would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to take 6 contact hours and stay out of trouble or the equivalent. 6 contact hours in treating children, 6 contact hours in boundaries and conflicts of interest, as well as take a 3-credit graduate level course in marriage and family therapy. In addition to that, there would be a practice restriction where she would not be able to take any new children or couples. With her current couples that she is seeing, she would be required to get clinical supervision for 2 hours a month. For those cases where she's providing marital counseling, the focus will be on conflict of interest, boundaries, documentation. and if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remain.
I would add in the supervision just family relationships.
Family relationships. Mm-hmm. Add family relationships to the focus.
Mm-hmm. So moved.
Procedurally, just a question, Ms. Vallis. This much education, including a graduate course, does 12 months make sense, or does 24 months with the possibility of early release make sense?
Well, you know, I think 12 months because of the clinical supervision makes sense. With that said, you know, she could request an extension on that graduate level course if she wanted, and we typically would grant it.
Okay. Is that your motion, Dr. Bailey? Is there a second?
10 seconds.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobrat.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Ms. Axford, you will receive communication from the board regarding next steps and outlining everything that we just talked about here today, and we appreciate you being available to participate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers, for being here as well. This will conclude this matter. All right, and that will bring us to our last disciplinary matter, 7E. Ms. Swift, she is present. A brief summary from board staff.
Yes, this matter is before the board for review, consideration, and possible action regarding opening a complaint and accepting the proposed signed interim consent agreement. On 6/2021, licensee submitted her LAC renewal application to the board. According to the police records, licensee was arrested on 3/10/21 and charged with a DWI to the two counts of possession of controlled substance and six counts of possession of a dangerous drug. In a conversation with the board's assistant director, licensee represented her sobriety date was 8/19/21. Given the above information, board staff contacted the licensee, who is in agreement to sign an ICA. That's attachment one. So it's here for the members to open up a complaint to consider accepting the ICA.
Any questions from Ms. Bella? Mr. Trotter, this is right.
Given the recent DWI, I think we should open a complaint and accept the ICA.
Motion?
Yes, ma'am.
You need to open a
complaint.
Open a complaint.
Oh, okay, but two separate ones?
What I prefer is
okay.
The record.
I motion we open a complaint.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
And now I propose that we accept the ICA temporarily suspending the professional's credentials.
Is there a second?
I am second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Break before we move forward now that we're done with this tonight.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to interrupt you, but because of the time, I think we could get this done within 5 minutes.
Okay. That's why I wanted to make sure.
Okay. Plan.
Okay. Agenda item, you want to go to 8?
8. That matter will be tabled till November.
You do have a plan. licenses? All right. We'll go to agenda item number 10. Licenses issued?
I would like to report that since our last board meeting, we have issued 209 licenses.
Wow.
All right, and in terms of our denials, counseling, want to please go first?
Yep. The Counseling Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 4 applications based on a failure to pass the required examination, 7 applications based on a failure to take the required examination, total denials, 11.
Okay. Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And social work.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee reviewed applications of 9 individuals and recommended their denial for licensure. 7 applications were recommended for denial based on a failure to pass the required examination. 1 application recommended for denial based on a failure to meet the minimum requirements, and 1 application recommended for denial based on a finding of unprofessional conduct. for a total of 9 denials, and I move it.
Second. Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Uh, 12 needs to be tabled. We don't have the financial report, correct?
That is correct.
We will table the September financial report, and that'll take us to 13.
And in going to 13, Madam Chair, members of the board, there's nothing that's urgent that can't wait until the November meeting, so I request that we wait until November to table all four matters.
Table A through D?
That is correct.
And 14, we have one request for an extension of inactive status. Summary.
Madam Chair, Ms. Ireland has submitted her second request for inactive status. As you know, the first extension can be granted by board staff. The second must be of three reasons, which is going to be medical, beyond the licensee's control, or military. Based on the information that's in here, based on the medical exemption, she's requesting a second inactive request. That's all I have.
There's two.
So move, Trotter.
Second. Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Any requests for future agenda items?
Well, I guess, is it an agenda item for us to further look at, I guess, possible rules?
I'd like to discuss court-appointed cases?
Yes.
Noted. We will put that on the agenda. Thank you, Mr. Trotter. Call for public comment. Anybody here to speak? All right. So that brings us to our future meeting date. Just a reminder, we continued the formal, so you can take that off of your calendars later this month. Our next meeting is Friday, November 5th. And, Ms. Valle, do you have a good count on who?
I would like a count, and just a special note, it's typically the second Friday. This is going to be the first Friday, so please make sure you note your calendars. Everybody here will be in attendance?
Yes.
All right. With that said, is there a motion to adjourn?
Davis moves it.
Trotter second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you all so much for the discussions today. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.